This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with retired Air Force Major Francis Goel. Today is March 3rd, 2009. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Goel is joining me by phone from Lebanon, Ohio. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct.
All right. Why don't we begin, if you don't mind, if you could tell me a little bit of biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in Chicago back in 37.
Okay.
And on the South Side, which was pretty eclectic neighborhood, I guess. Went to the typical grade schools and all-boys high school, and then went on to college at Northern Illinois University and taught for a couple of years and then joined the Air Force.
Okay. All right. Before we get into that, if you don't mind, if we could back up just a little bit, talk about growing up and that type of thing. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
My mother's name was Evangeline. Her maiden name was Gunlock. She was born in Toledo.
Okay.
She worked in a cosmetic factory before she and my dad got married. My dad was a house painter.
Okay.
And he was born in Chicago. And essentially they spent, I guess, 90% of their lives in Chicago. They eventually retired to Florida for the last few years.
Okay.
But Dad was a painter all his life. And, of course, once they got married, Mom essentially did the bookkeeping. He went into business for himself in the probably late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, obviously, I ended up being a house painter.
Oh, right, sure. Okay. So then you grew up in Chicago then?
Yes, I did.
Okay. What did you do for fun as a kid in Chicago?
I'm sorry, what?
What did you do for fun as a kid and growing up in Chicago?
Oh, play baseball, football, little soccer, little ice hockey, but not particularly organized, but more neighborhood sort of stuff, which we had in those days.
Sure. Sir. All right. Growing up, did you have any interest in the military as a kid, or was that something that came about later?
During World War II, we had the folks went down to Navy Pier. They went down to the different military USOs, and I would say almost every weekend we had servicemen in the house that Mom and Dad kind of entertained.
Okay.
And used to, you know, hear the stories. And, yeah, I grew up, from the time I can remember, I wanted to be in the military.
Okay. All right. So then, do you remember World War II pretty well then?
I remember the latter half of it fairly well.
All right.
And I don't necessarily say I remember the war per se, but I remember the involvement.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And the stories we heard. We had, obviously, neighbors who were serving in Europe and in the Far East.
Okay. All right. Let's see. What about going to school? Could you tell me a little bit about your education, elementary school and high school?
Yeah, I went to a place called Beale Elementary School. It was at about 60th and Sangamon in Chicago. Typical kindergarten through eighth grade, all totally integrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say there was anything particularly unique about it. It was just a typical Chicago school.
Okay.
I went to Tilden Technical High School because, I don't know, I wanted a technical education. I really anticipated going into the blue-collar workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And still had an interest in, at that time, joining the Army because that was during the Korean War. I thought, well, as soon as I get out of high school, I'll join the Army.
Right.
And I graduated from high school in 54. The Korean War was pretty much phasing down. And I looked into Air Force ROTC, but didn't find a school that I guess I could qualify to get into. I wasn't particularly an outstanding student.
Okay.
And I have no idea why, but I went to Northern Illinois State Teachers College, which morphed into Northern Illinois University.
Yes, sir.
And met my current wife there. we decided to get married, and I sort of didn't think too much about the military for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Got a degree in geology and also teaching, and was working on my advanced degree at the same time. I got hooked on education about then,
mm-hmm.
and decided to go on to teaching. And my wife just walked by and said, don't forget, I belong to Civil Air Patrol also.
Okay.
And I joined that in my last year of high school and continued on through the college years.
Okay. Could you...
And, my roommate, who also eventually went in the Air Force, we were both in the CAP.
All right. Could you tell me a little bit about the CAP and what it did?
As a high school student, it basically provided some basics in what now would be called aerospace education.
Okay.
Sort of to try to interest you, I think, more into the enlisted corps than into the officer corps.
Uh-huh.
But it was kind of social as well as paramilitary.
Mm-hmm.
And when we left high school and became a part of what was called the senior corps, it was more job-related. A lot of the guys had pilot's licenses. We did some search and rescue type stuff relative to planes being lost or people being lost.
Mm-hmm.
And took a summer session at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, devoted strictly to aerospace education. My wife and I and a couple others, we bought a couple airplanes and taught ourselves to fly.
Okay.
And I still had the bug, I guess, to join the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So came along a program called OTS.
Mm-hmm.
Because I couldn't get into aviation cadets. I was already married. And I hadn't gone through ROTC, and the Air Force Academy hadn't essentially even been in existence at the time.
Right.
So when the OTS program came along, I applied for it and ended up in the first class of OTS, entering the service in November of 1959.
November 59. All right. Where did you attend OTS?
Lackland Air Force Base.
Okay. All right. Before we get into that, I wanted to ask you just a moment real quickly about one more question about growing up. And as the Korean War is going on, as the Cold War was continuing during this time, did you pay close attention to what was going on in the world and what was going on with the Cold War?
As far as the Korean War, yeah, I guess. Because of the time when we were going through the Atomic Revolution,
mm-hmm.
and the Korean War, I guess I paid a lot of attention to the Korean War because I had kind of planned on joining the Army. I figured that's where I'd end up.
Right. Yes, sir. Okay. And you mentioned you taught there for a little while. What were you teaching?
I was teaching earth science in Elmwood Park, Illinois.
Okay. And you did that for what?
Two years.
2 years before going into
OT? Before entering the service, yeah.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about OTS, just a little bit about the training and the daily routine?
OTS was kind of an experiment for the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
as well as us. We were in the first class, so we didn't have an upper-class corps to harass us.
Right.
So they gave us a bunch of sergeants with lots of stripes to harass us.
Mm-hmm.
But it was basically an introduction to the military. It was a 90-day wonder course. We had classes in different aspects of officership and Air Force history, drill ceremonies. We did a lot of drilling. We did a lot of PT, you know, the things going through Air Force basic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And they combined the basic along with the coursework to eventually get a commission. During that time, what was known as the Tiger was still loose, so we had the square meals. And not probably as bad as, nowhere near as bad, I'm sure, as military academies. But we got some minimal harassing, you know, in-your-face sort of stuff. And
mm-hmm.
Essentially, we lived in the... a converted women's barracks, actually, at Lackland,
okay,
by a place called Seymour Hall. And since we were married, about halfway through the program, my wife came down, even though we were restricted to the post. You know, I mean, it wasn't like we went home or anything, but on weekends, we got off at noon, and we had from noon Saturday, if we were good guys and got, you know, the afternoon off, we had from noon Saturday to noon Sunday to where we were free.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and a couple other wives all gathered together and lived over at Billy Mitchell Village on, Kelly. And they were living at a place called Billy Mitchell Village on Kelly. So from noon Saturday to noon Sunday, we sort of got together with our wives.
Mm-hmm.
And Sunday at noon, we were back in the Air Force.
Right. Okay.
And in, well, 90-some days later, January, February time frame of 1960, we graduated. And the primary, one of the primary purposes of OTS at that time was to bring navigators into the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
The aviation cadet program was producing enough pilots, but apparently they were short of navigators. So I guess about 50% or more of our OTS class went to Harlingen for navigator training at graduation.
Okay.
There was no option to go to pilot training. We agreed at the very beginning we'd be navigators.
Mm. All right. How did you feel about that?
Didn't bother me at all as long as I could fly.
Okay. All right. Just a few more questions about OTS before we get into your more advanced training.
Okay.
What did you think of the instructors and their methods of teaching and their methods of discipline? And also, were these Korean War vets?
Primarily, I would say, you know, they were Korean War, and the majority of them were World War II vets.
Okay.
There were a few younger people, but, you know, our sergeants typically were senior tech sergeants, master sergeants. The cadre of officers were captains, first lieutenants, and captains and first lieutenants in those days didn't progress as quickly as they do nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, a lot of them had air experience or war experience in either both or at least the Korean War.
Okay.
I thought they were pretty good guys. I mean, we were pretty still starstruck and pretty impressed with the way things went. We were aware, you know, we're a college graduate. We were aware that we were going to go through the BS of initial discipline, mm-hmm, et cetera, et cetera, and we just accepted it as kind of a game.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Did you find the training fairly sufficient for preparing you for your later career?
I think so, yeah. They instilled, they really worked a lot on commitment, integrity, career.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, you know, well, try this and see if you like it. It was more, we're anticipating you're going to come on active duty and you're going to stay for a career. So it was career motivated more than just job motivated.
Okay. All right. And how did you feel you were adjusting to the military lifestyle?
Oh, I had my ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
There were days where, you know, I said, you know, why do I need to do this? Because I could have had another life.
Right.
But overall, I think, you know, we had a good adjustment. I made friends there that I still have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And what did your family and your wife, what did they think about you joining the Air Force and then making a career of it?
My mother was definitely against it.
Okay.
My brother-in-law was also in the Air Force. He was a pilot and preceded me in the Air Force by about 4 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was definitely not in favor. Dad was pretty non-committal. You know, he said, if that's what you want to do, fine, do it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really want me to spend my entire life in the painting trade, but I guess he would have just as soon I did didn't join the military, but, you know, we weren't at war in 59.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
My wife was definitely in favor. In fact, you know, it was a sort of a giant, we had been married 2 years, so it wasn't that she wasn't aware of my desire to go in the Air Force, and she fully supported it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Once you finished with OTS and went on to advanced, how much time was there between the two?
We had about a week between OTS and arrival at Harlingen for navigator training.
Okay. Where is Harlingen?
Harlingen is at the south end of Texas, down by Brownsville.
Okay. All right. Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about the about your training there and just, again, the daily routine and that type of thing?
Harlingen Air Force Base, navigator training. You spent part-time in classes, part-time still doing some, you know, military training, marching, et cetera, but not to the extent of the basic. And then, of course, you're flying training.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, the classroom training in those days, there was still some officership, even though by then we were commissioned. But it was learning how to use the electronics and mechanics to fly an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Back in those days, we still didn't have all the electronic gee whiz stuff that they have today. So consequently, what we were learning was the navigation that was probably still predominant in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And flying, we flew in the T-29.
All right.
And typically, we'd go to class, let's say, 3 days a week and fly 2 days a week.
All
and
right.
Flights were from Harlingen up to Cheneyville, Louisiana, or up to Sweetwater, Texas, and back. They truly were pretty routine, but when you're first learning, they didn't seem routine.
Mm, sure. Okay. Now, as a... as training to be a navigator, was one of your duties as well to be able to fly, also to be able to pilot the plane in case it was needed?
No.
Okay.
That was not a consideration, although as we progressed into active flying, a lot of us probably did learn a little bit about flying the airplane.
Okay. All right. Well, with your training with the T-29, could you talk a little bit about how the navigator would be trained in that situation?
Okay, in the T-29, you had your pilot and co-pilot actually flying the airplane. You had an instructor or two on board, and typically anywhere from 8 to 12 students.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a basic setup, an altimeter, airspeed indicator, compass, Loran, basic radar, and celestial drift meters, all the things that essentially were still in airplanes in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And we addressed each system sort of as a unique system, beyond the basics of airplot and dead reckoning looking out the window.
Okay.
We took radar separately, we took Loran separately, we took Celestial separately, and then at the end of the program, the last few weeks of the program, you combined them all together and started using them as you would have in, you know, operational systems. And our, what I would call our final, really final flights was we flew from Harlingen to Tampa to Kinley in Bermuda, spent a day or two in Bermuda and then flew back, and this was putting together all of the systems. Part of the way out, we were flying at night, and on the way back, we flew in the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
And in, what was it, October, I guess, of 60, we got our wings.
Okay. All right. Were these systems you mentioned, were they unique to specific aircraft, or was this pretty general for most of the aircraft we had, and the aircraft that you would be working on?
They were general to the aircraft we would be flying.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the radar system we had in the T-29 was a partially equivalent to the bomb system they had in the B-47 and early B-52s.
Okay.
So it was a darn good system.
Mm-hmm.
When we went on to operational flying, some people were very disappointed in what they actually got.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Excuse me. Talk a little bit about, and this may be somewhat repetitive, but a little bit about just basic aircraft navigation and how it would be done, if that's a, you know, if you could talk a little about that.
Okay, and let me kind of put it in a more combined system.
Okay.
On a typical flight, the first thing you do, obviously, is go on pre-flight the airplane, which is to check that the instruments are, in fact, working before you take off.
Okay.
And then get a briefing, a sit-down briefing about what the mission goals were and how you're anticipating to accomplish them.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm talking training. And the instructor would give you your particular goals to accomplish and the grading system. Then we'd check our parachutes and all that good stuff and get it all in place. Getting the airplane, take off, and fly to a known departure point, which was down there in the lower valley. Typically, I can't think of the town up from Harlingen. It has sort of a Scotch name. But in any case, you would depart at altitude on a given heading that you had pre-flighted, you know, where you made your plans.
Mm-hmm.
And then monitor the aircraft, the altitude, the airspeed, and practice on whatever particular system you're using, whether it be radar, looking out the window, celestial. We still had things called drift meters where you could look through a tube at the bottom of the airplane, measure the speed of the airplane, the drift of the airplane.
Okay.
And we had a fairly decent Loran system in there if we were going over water, which gave us sort of an electronic lines that you just cross-checked on a chart and then plotted them where they intersected. That was hopefully where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the first leg, the last 6 or 8 minutes, you predicted a position based on your flight information up to that point, and you were graded on the actual position versus your predicted position.
Okay.
Then you turn around and do the same thing coming back.
Mm-hmm. All right. How did you do?
I was, let's see, I think we were 20-some and 25 or 30 in the class, and I was probably midway.
Okay. All right.
Far enough to avoid B-52s.
Yes, sir. All right. How about the instructors here? Would you give them high marks as well?
I would, but in all honesty, they were all young kids who had just basically graduated from navigator training themselves.
Okay.
Probably within a year.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, being unknown completely, everything they said seemed to be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we were impressed. Hell, they were wearing wings.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, were there any memorable moments or humorous moments or anything like that from that training that stick out in your mind?
Well, there's a couple.
Okay.
Travis Hoover was our Deputy Wing Commander. Travis Hoover was number two off of the aircraft carrier with Jimmy Doolittle.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And we got to fly with Colonel Hoover a few times and actually got to know him. He was a really nice guy. In fact, my wife and I had bought some furniture over in Matamoros,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't have a means of getting it back. And Colonel Hoover was over in Matamoros with his girlfriend, who was a movie star, Joan Blondell.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought it back for us, unbeknownst to us.
Hmm.
And my folks were down visiting us, and I got a call from the deputy wing commander. And it was one of those, get your butt up here because you're in deep serious problems.
Right.
Going, oh, God, I don't remember doing anything. So Dad drove out to the base with me, and he obviously was sitting outside. And I went in, reporting here to Colonel Hoover. I don't know what I did, but, you know, I'll make up for it. And he called me, and he stood me there and says, do you know that I had to sneak back your furniture? And I caught the smile on his face at that point, and he said, sit down and relax, Lieutenant.
Right.
And we had a chat, and he said, oh, your dad's here? You know, bring him in. So we had kind of a nice little meeting with Colonel Hoover.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we were kind of still starstruck because Colonel Hoover was on the raid with Jimmy Doolittle. You know, it was kind of, wow, this is really neat stuff.
Right, yes, sir.
But I guess the other unique thing was one that boarded me into my closest friendship throughout most of my life here. My roommate in OTS and I can't say got along really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
We got along because it was necessary. And one day, we were both in nav train, both in the same squadron, and been flying together. And we went over to the club and sat down and says, you know, there's something that we need to sort out. And we talked for a while, and we got past our little, I guess, disagreements of the past and said, you know, we need to start promoting each other instead of trying to tear each other down.
Mm-hmm.
And we just totally changed our outlook. And over time, we became not only best friends, but my wife and I are godparents of his children, and he and his wife are the godparents of our children.
Oh, wow.
And we're still in contact. I mean, we've been lifelong friends now for 50 years.
Mm. Yes, sir.
But beyond that, you know, good times down in Harlingen. We used to go out to Padre Island before Padre Island was anything unique. It was a rusty old bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd drive up the island on weekends and party.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. I guess one last question about advanced training.
Okay.
Did you find that it was, sufficient as far as preparing you to be a navigator?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is, which may get into your next question, we went directly to operational units. We didn't go to advanced training after navigator training unless you were going to SAC and B-52s or B-47s.
Okay.
We went to operational units, and when I signed in, that roommate and I both signed in at the same time, same squadron. We were going to B-50s at the time, KB-50, which was a refueling wing.
Okay.
We got there just before Christmas, and we weren't checked out in the KB-50, but because we had come out of navigator training, the wing commander asked us if we had knew what a C-54 was. He says, yeah, we know what a C-54 is. He says, good, because you're now qualified to fly it, and you're taking it to the Azores and Bermuda, and I'm going to be your aircraft commander.
Mm, okay.
And we're going like, maybe we ought to think about this.
Right.
But it turned out to be a really fun trip.
Okay. All right. And what was the unit that you were assigned to again?
Sorry. I was assigned to the 4505th Air Refueling Wing at Langley.
Okay.
427th Squadron flying KB-50s.
Okay. All right. How long were you at this post?
I flew KB-50s from 1960 to 1963 when they went out of service here in the States.
Okay. All right. And what type of different missions or duties would you be performing?
We're in tactical air refueling.
Mm-hmm.
The KB-50, unlike the SAC-135s and 97s, we had a probe and drogue system, so we had three hoses that one come out of the tail and one on each wing, and we could service tactical fighters up through the B-66 anywhere from 1 to 3 aircraft at a time. So we were occupying a lot of space flying very close together.
Okay.
And our refueling missions typically were between the United States and Bermuda, between Bermuda and the Azores, and between the Azores and Europe.
Okay. All right. Let's see. How much of this time, I guess, let's see, how should I phrase this? How much time would you be in the air? How many missions would you fly, during this time period?
Typically, we logged, we logged about 300 to 400 hours a year, and a typical mission would last anywhere from 6 to 10 hours.
Okay.
Depending on, how far out and what our refueling track was. We were refueling, everything from the F-100 to the F-105, the F-4s when they first came in service.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you weren't on refueling missions, how would you spend your downtime?
Upgrading the pilot letdown plates, and I was in charge of the refueling operators. We had the enlisted men, the crew in a B-50. KB-50 was 2 pilots, a navigator. We were officers.
Mm-hmm.
Flight engineer and 2 refueling operators, and they were enlisted. And my secondary job was to be the officer in charge of the refueling operators.
Okay.
Which meant really that I had a couple of master sergeants and tech sergeants who told me what to do every day, and I did it.
Okay.
But a lot of the time was spent in mission planning. We did a lot of other training in as far as, survival, water survival, these sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
We were not on a war footing until the Berlin crisis.
Right.
So essentially it was pretty relaxed until the Berlin thing hit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did Berlin change the mission?
Berlin was the crisis of, I guess it was 61.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time that we started thinking about our actual, commitment to what we were going to do. We got called out in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
We're briefed on the fact that the wall was going up, and it looked like there may be an engagement with the Russian forces. And we took a combined air strike force of F-100s. And we left the States. We refueled them over the Atlantic between Bermuda. We went on. They went on. We refueled them again between Bermuda and the Azores. We landed. And they went on to another refueling with another group of B-50s, because we had B-50s pre-positioned in Bermuda and in the Azores.
Okay.
We fueled up, and the next morning we were out there between the Azores and Europe, taking another group into Europe. And we were essentially ready for, I guess, the big ball to go up, which it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent, probably 45 days out in the Azores then, just running aircraft and strike force support for the buildup going on in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
After that point, we went back to Langley and essentially back to a semi-routine of taking fighters back and forth across the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right.
So we were pretty busy.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it, absolutely.
Our strike force, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but there were some pictures. We had a photographer aboard. And our strike force was, if I remember correctly, about 8 KB-50s, and each one had two F-100s assigned to it, so we had a strike force of 16 F-100s with us. Mm-hmm. And we essentially did their navigation and kept them refueled. The F-100 and the KV-50 were fairly compatible, more so than as the Century series went on as far as speed realms. When you get up to something beyond the F-101, get up to the F-104, the F-105, those guys couldn't fly as slow as we could go fast.
So right.
Essentially, what we would do then is point them to the next group of tankers and send them from tanker rendezvous to tanker rendezvous.
Okay. All right. How about the, I guess I don't know if you'd phrase it this way, but just the tactics involved in refueling, what would the operation be? How would you, I guess, what the tactics involved?
Okay, typically our briefing would send us out to a rendezvous point, a rendezvous area, where the fighters would meet us. And mm-hmm. what we'd do is we'd fly out to that point and go into a racetrack orbit. And once we got out to the point and into the racetrack orbit, it was strictly a navigator's mission because we had the rendezvous radar mm-hmm. plus our position keeping and keeping track of where we were at.
Right.
And we were using what was known as an APX-29, which had a range of about 200 miles. And we could pick up the fighters on their IFF, which was an electronic identification. And we could pick them up typically around 130 to 140 miles. On a good day, you got them out a little further. But the typical range was out there, the 130 so. And we would find them, guide them to us. And at a point, we would try to be pulling out of a turn on their flight heading just about the time they were 5 miles from us. So it was essentially a matter of planning position turns to make sure that we were in front of them so they didn't have to jockey around. And once they got about 5 to 8 miles behind us, they would come down from altitude, slow down, and we would put our drogues out, the hoses they were going to refuel off of, and we would accelerate to 240 knots, which is pretty slow, comparatively speaking, but the F-100s could come down there and get on the hose, and we'd guide them in until they were visual, and then they'd come in onto the hose, and we would pump them full of fuel. And once they were off the hose, pumped full of fuel, in a typical mission, we would give them a heading to take to the next rendezvous. And, of course, that next rendezvous would be, maybe 700 miles or so downstream from where we had gotten them.
Okay.
And then we would go back into orbit for the next group or return to base if there were no further groups coming out.
Mm-hmm.
We did this day, night, all sorts of weather. It didn't matter.
Okay. All right. How was it ever difficult, I guess, making that connection to refueling the planes? Was that difficult at times? Or?
There were difficulties sometimes, yeah.
Okay.
The difficulties were typically weather-related.
Mm-hmm.
If the weather was lousy, having them, even though we could see them electronically, getting them into visual contact was sometimes difficult for them. And depending on their fuel criticality, you know, how much they had burned, how excited they were.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes they'd come in and have difficulty with the turbulence, et cetera, getting that little probe into the hose. The hose was, if I remember, about 50 feet long.
Okay.
And so you're in pretty close proximity to the back end of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Once you hooked up on the hose, you were flying probably 20 feet from the trailing edge of the B-50 wing, and your wings on the F-100 were very close to the fuselage of the B-50. In fact, if you took a B-66 on one of the wings, the guy had to actually fly at a tilt because his wing would overlap the fuselage of the airplane.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And we were, I guess, young and dumb because it didn't bother us a bit.
All right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, go ahead.
We had a little excitement one day over the Atlantic. We got struck by lightning in the wing during the refueling. And it punched 8 feet of our wingtip off.
Oh, wow.
Including the refueling unit, and caught fire. It, you know, was exciting for everybody, including the guy trying to refuel.
Oh, sure, I bet.
But we were fortunate. We weren't sure whether the airplane would burn or not.
Mm-hmm.
And fire went out, and we did get back. But, you know, we were obviously excited, a little adrenaline rush.
Right, sure. Yes, sir. All right.
And another time with an F-104, the guy's oxygen system went out, and they turned back to go to Bermuda, and our real operator was able to essentially fly this young man's F-104 with his hose and coordinating with our pilot as to, you know, slow down, speed up, climb, descend until we got this young man refueled because he was hypoxic as heck.
Mm.
And they got him back to Bermuda alive. And, in fact, our young scanner was rewarded with an air medal.
Oh, wow. Yes, sir.
But other than that, I say routine. Routine often was exciting, but, you know, it was just kind of a fun job.
Okay. All right. You you mentioned a little bit earlier, you talked about water survival training and stuff and those types of things. Could you talk a little bit about that?
In the early days, water survival, since we were at Langley, we would do it just off the coast at Langley.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd go out after some classwork on how to survive. You'd go out and experience getting dumped in the water and climbing into a one-man life raft and climbing into what they said was a 20-man life raft. I don't think you could put 20 men in it, but it was okay. And sit out in the ocean for a couple hours and supposedly get the idea of what water survival would be all about. And I guess we did that almost yearly, and it became sort of a fun thing. I had one experience where, back in those days, the astronauts, prior to actually going into space, were training at Langley.
Okay.
And my boss volunteered me to go do some experimental life rafting for the astronauts.
Hmm.
Because when Shepard went up, he did not have a life raft. He was basically locked in his little capsule.
Okay.
And then Grissom went up, and you may be aware of the problems Grissom had. He climbed out of his capsule. The capsule sunk, etc. And so before Mr. Glenn went up, they wanted to do some testing, and they designed a paper life raft. So we went out in the Atlantic with the astronauts, three or four of them, and we tested different systems. And so I got to work with three or four of the astronauts and test some of their systems. And it was interesting in the fact that they had told Gus Grissom that he should have not worried about, you know, floating out there in his spacesuit because his spacesuit was definitely a floatable thing. Well, they put the spacesuit on a young man and put him over the side, and he went straight to the bottom.
Oh, goodness.
He had a safety rope on, so they hauled him in. Well, John Glenn looked at that and said, you know, I don't think that's acceptable.
Sure.
So they did some redesigning, some reworking of sort of a underarm life preserver for Glenn before he went.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of interesting to work with the astronauts, even though I only worked with them for a few days, maybe a week. And I often wonder, golly, I should have got all those guys' autographs.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, we were just essentially working together and didn't think of those things in those days.
Right, yes, sir. What was your impression of them?
Oh, I was impressed. I mean, these guys are going to go into space. It mm-hmm. wasn't something I wanted to do.
Right.
And they were, around Langley, they were demigods.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they could ask for almost anything and they would probably get it.
Mm-hmm.
John Glenn was a very unique individual. He was very mission motivated, and, you know, we were all really impressed with John. The other guys spent maybe a little more time at the bar than he did, but well, given any day of the week, if the astronauts came in, like, to the barber shop, they got, you know, first in line treatment, etc. And I don't remember anyone complaining.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, as far as your assignment with the 45th and 5th goes, when did you said you completed that assignment in 63?
Yeah, the KB-50 was taken out of service, and as it was going through its withdrawal from service, eight of us were assigned to C-130s, transition to C-130s at Seward, because we were going to become a C-130 outfit.
All right.
And so while the KB-50s were still operating and being slowly withdrawn, eight crews went to C-130 CCTS at Seward Air Force Base in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And we became the vanguard, I guess, for our squadron and wing changeover. So we became a part of the 463rd Troop Carrier Wing.
Okay.
And Seward was just essentially, a 6 or 8 week TDY while we learned how to fly the C-130. And equipment-wise, the C-130 was not as well equipped for a navigator as was the KB-50.
Mm-hmm.
It, let's say, lacked some of the uniqueness we had. The radar was less capable. The airplane was much more comfortable, obviously. The B-50 was essentially a B-29 Big Brother.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't have all the creature comforts. The 130 had loads of creature comforts.
Okay.
So even though the radar, et cetera, wasn't probably as nice, didn't have a drift meter, the creature comforts made up for the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the 130s were all kind of brand new in those days.
Okay.
All right. CCTS was essentially not learning how to fly, but learning how to fly the C-130 and learning the unique mission. Besides just flying from point A to point B or doing the refueling, we were getting into dropping heavy equipment, dropping troopers out, so we spent a lot of time up at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, going through the low-level drop missions.
Okay. All right. Could you talk about the tactics involved with that, with these low-level drop missions?
Essentially, in the training phase, low-level drop mission, we'd go up to Fort Campbell, and depending on whether it was heavy equipment or whether it was troops, would affect the drop altitudes, but we'd essentially plan about a one-hour mission,
mm-hmm.
in which you'd fly a closed circuit from Fort Campbell back to the drop zones on Fort Campbell. And if they were troop drops, we'd drop them at 1,000 or 1,200 feet. And if they were equipment drops, we'd drop them from 1,500 feet.
Okay.
And what you do is you take off, fly at those altitudes in those days, the early days, and fly to four or five different checkpoints and then establish a run in from what was called an initial point, the last 5 or 6 minutes of flight. And you'd slow down from 210 knots to drop speeds of 120 to 125 for troops to 130 for heavy equipment. And on your run-in, you identified the drop zone, and they'd pop smoke on where they wanted the stuff to fall. And at 6 minutes out, you'd give the loadmaster warning. They'd go through the checklist of getting the stuff ready to go out of the airplane. They'd release the locks on the heavy equipment, open the doors, and you'd be flying there at 125 knots, 130 knots for heavy. And the last 6 minutes, you were just in that mode. At 1 minute out, you gave them a warning, and everything was ready to go out the door at what we call green light, which was the point of release. They dropped the reefed chute for heavy equipment, and that was a chute that actually pulled the load out of the airplane. And then the actual parachutes for the heavy equipment load would open. With the troopers at 1 minute out, they essentially were in the door ready to go. You hit green light point, the drop point, and out they went. And it was, I guess, pretty routine.
Okay.
It wasn't what we actually used in combat.
Okay.
But it was the way we trained at that point. Vietnam was still not a part of our thinking.
Right.
And then we, once we completed CCTS, we were augmentation forces for the C-130 units in Europe and the C-130 units down the Panama Canal Zone. And so we fit into what was called rotation, and we'd go on rotation for anywhere from 30 to 90 days to these units as augmentation units, not attack.
Okay. Right. And what types of places would you be flying to here?
I spent most of my time in those days rotating down to Panama and flying throughout South America.
Okay.
Central and South America until the Vietnam thing came along. Our sister squadron, I was in the 427th, 429th, I'm sorry, when we went to 130, we were in the 774th, and the 772nd, 773rd typically did rotations to Evreux, France, and we typically did the rotations to Central and South America.
Okay.
Even though the promised Paris rotations were coming, it never happened.
All right. In these flights to South America, what type of supplies or equipment would you be hauling?
We were basically hauling stuff in for support for small groups, army units, and just, I guess we called it trash hauling, but essentially whatever needed to be moved around Central and South America. We flew often into Rio, into Colombia, Costa Rica, all the Central and South American countries along there. Typically it was support material for the diplomatic missions, etc. And then we did a lot of training with the airborne units down in the canal zone.
Okay. All right. When you would go on one of these missions, would it just be getting rid of the equipment, dropping the equipment, and then heading back, or would you spend any time on the ground?
Most of them were actually not airdrop missions. They were typically fly cargo to some point, drop it off, spend a day there, and fly back to the canal zone. Like when we went down to Rio, we'd have a bunch of stuff for the diplomatic mission in Rio, and we'd take it in, drop it off, and fly to cargo from Rio to someplace else that had to go, and then eventually, you know, wander our way back to the canal zone. So we might be out 3, 4, or 5 days.
Okay.
Training missions in the canal zone were essentially the same as training missions up at Fort Campbell. Load the troops on or load the heavy equipment on and fly into their drop zones at Rio Hato and I think a place was called Venado Beach right there at Howard Air Force Base. We did occasionally get calls to do humanitarian service. One time we flew into someplace up there by Lake Titicaca and evacuated some sick people.
Mm-hmm.
And another time we flew into an area down in Panama into a jungle and actually dropped tents into people who had been burned out by a fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had both the humanitarian sort of things that 130s did and the routine stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty decent life,
okay.
Except we were always doing it as rotational TDY, so we were away from home an awful lot of time. In fact, in 1 year, I think I was TDY away from Langley for almost 11 months.
Okay. Oh, wow. All right.
The wife said, "Who are you?"
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, any particularly memorable moments that stick out in your mind from this time period?
Well, the run into Garrison Province in Panama, we were trying to put the stuff in to a drop zone about 200 foot by 200 foot, and we were going in really low level. I mean, we were right on the deck. In fact, we hit a tree.
Mm.
Yeah, picked up some greenery in our ramp. Not that we believed that we had hit the tree until the loadmaster threw the greenery up on the flight deck and said, "See, you did too." Obviously, we didn't hit it hard enough to, you know, be exciting.
Right. Yes.
But I do have a picture where we're coming in over the top of, and I don't know why the Army had a photographer there, but somebody got a picture of us, and we're about, I'd say, 20 feet off the ground, and there's a native sort of walking and looking at, "Oh my God, what's that thing there?" And whoever took the picture sent us one, which eventually found its way to where I got this great picture of an airplane, C-130, and the native hooches and this young native looking at us like, "Oh my God."
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the other one was where we air-evac'd some people out of, like you say, up in Titicaca, because we were landing on an airstrip up around, I guess, 10, 12,000 feet. So final approach was made at 180 knots.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Let's see. You said you were flying basically these types of missions until things started to heat up in Vietnam, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it was the summer of 1963. Something went on over there, and we deployed to the Philippines and then started flying missions into essentially Saigon and Bangkok and those areas.
Okay.
And we flew out of Clark,
mm-hmm.
essentially, and did some, you know, you go into Tons Nhut and stay overnight and then go into Bangkok and then back to the Philippines. And that was, if I remember correctly, about a 90-day deployment.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 64, I guess it was, when we had the one-shot thing,
mm-hmm.
The Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Right.
Now, we had been rotational, and for the Gulf of Tonkin, we flew from Langley to pick up 105 maintenance stuff, and then we flew on to the West Coast, to Hawaii, to Aniwetok, to Guam, to Da Nang, to Karat, and we took the stuff into Karat. And I don't mean we had a lot of crew rest. We just essentially flew and flew and flew.
Mm.
We were met by the flight surgeon at each point who certified we were able to go on to the next point. So it was kind of a 60-hour day, I guess.
Mm. Wow.
And from Karat, we recovered up to Tachikawa, because we had to get something else up at Tachi, and we went into crew rest at Tachi, and then crew rest was kind of an elongated rest up, and then we flew back down into Da Nang, and I don't remember what we dropped off. Then we recovered out of Da Nang to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And then we operated out of Naha, Okinawa, on a regular shuttle basis into Vietnam and into the Thailand bases, Karat, Udorn, Bangkok, bringing in supplies,
mm-hmm.
getting ready for the buildup. And again, we spent another 90 days in and out of Vietnam, typically into Da Nang, Tan Sanut, and a couple of the more C-130 friendly bases in those days.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to ask you, those early missions that you were flying into Vietnam, I guess the first few missions, what was your early impressions of the country?
We were pretty excited going into Vietnam because we had heard that they shoot at airplanes.
Mm.
Mind you, we saw probably more non-existent sort of things, more the imagined things for the first couple of missions.
Mm-hmm.
But our impression of Vietnam was it was just kind of a, it wasn't as warlike as I guess we anticipated it was supposed to be. It was pretty calm,
mm-hmm.
pretty civil. We didn't find much to be exciting after the first few runs in, and we got past those, oh my God, it's a combat zone sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was kind of funny because in the early missions, if we flew back to Naha, we actually got those combat rations of debriefing and a shot of whiskey.
Okay.
Oh, boy, what a thrill.
Right.
The buildup at Naha, though, was becoming pretty tough on the base to support because we had all the 130 units coming out of the States plus the 130 units they already had there, and they just kind of ran out of room where to store people.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up in, I guess, the base commander's house, and he went and lived somewhere else, so we had a couple of crews occupying his quarters. It was kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
We had a little mom-son who took care of all our basic washing and drying and keep the place clean needs.
Mm-hmm.
We were on probably a fly every second or third day sort of thing.
Okay. Would you spend much time on the ground in Vietnam, or was it just, again, dropping off the supplies and leaving?
Typically, it was drop things off, and then if they had missions in-country, load up, fly to the different places in-country, drop things off, come back to usually Tan Sanut, or recover back at Naha.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd spend two or three days in-country, or as in those days they called it, down south.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd recover back at Naha, and then we'd take some more stuff down. And that went on and on. Time frames, we were over there for, again, about 90 days. We came back to the States and went on typical rotations. In fact, in 65, I guess it was, we did a couple of rotations into Naha and spent more and more time. We were starting to spend more time in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And in 65, we were over there for a rotation, and we got our orders to become a permanent change of station PCS.
Okay.
And so in September of 65, I was on the essentially the first massive airborne assault by paratroopers into the Michelin rubber plantation up there. And we were not flying as Americans. We were flying as Vietnamese C-130s.
Okay.
And so consequently, we had a Vietnamese advisor aboard. I don't know what he was going to advise, but it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we did the first, essentially, Vietnamese airborne invasion I don't remember how many airplanes, but oh, maybe 15 airplanes, with each airplane having 100 Vietnamese paratroopers. And it was kind of an exciting mission because we were going to have a dawn attack, but apparently we didn't get off till almost noon, so it wasn't much of a dawn attack.
Okay.
Well, the mission was exciting, but we couldn't talk about it in those days because it was all highly hush-hush, and we weren't supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. What was your early impression of the South Vietnamese, of the troops?
I was not overly impressed with them.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't negative to them, but I can't say that I was over impressed.
Okay.
We heard lots of rumors about how good or how bad they were, and I wouldn't want to evaluate them on the fact of, you know, I didn't have enough contact with them except as we dropped them to get an impression of how they operated on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I later on did.
Okay. All right. I've heard these stories and these rumors about the Arvin and their performance capabilities. And I guess you don't have to really go into this at this point, but I guess in this mission, when you were first, you dropped them in that mission, I've heard stories about, you know, airdrops for Arvin, and they didn't want to get off the plane and that type of thing. Was there any sort of problems with that?
No, not in that in that particular mission, not at all.
Okay.
It later on, I've seen some writings on the mission. I could describe the mission to you. I don't know if it's of any interest.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. We were sent over from, let's see, we were at Clark at the time, and we went into Tonsonute. And we were all built up for leading this particular mission. The wing commanders were all going to fly, and it was sort of one of those, everybody wanted to be on it, but nobody really wanted to be on it. In any case, we planned it as supposedly a surprise. The B-52s were going to come in and sanitize the area, and then we were going to get support from the B-26s and the A-1s. So we knew we were going to have a lot of heavy fire support. But we went out, like I say, after planning this thing, and like I think there were 15 airplanes, and we were no longer going to be in this little V formations that we practiced in those days. We were going in what was called an entrail. And your lead was a couple hundred feet in front of number two, who was offset to the left, and then a couple hundred feet back, your number three was offset to the right. And then there was a short gap, and then number four came in as essentially the same track as the lead, and it just went down through the five units. Our actual flight altitude going into, that we were planning on going into the drop zone, was going to be 300 feet, and then as we approached the planned paradrop point, we were going to pop up to 1,000 feet and drop the troops. The reality of that was, as we planned the mission, we realized that there might be people who were not going to be friendly shooting at us. So we went in a lot lower, and we popped up to about 750 feet. And in the actual mission, I was flying the number four slot, second element lead.
Okay.
And as we approached the drop zone initial point, we realized we were going to the wrong place. And we called the first element lead and told them so. And then they came to the reality that we were going in the wrong place. And so we pulled off of the initial point run, did a sort of circle, flew to the actual initial point, and flew on into the mission. By that time, the whole area was in chaos, and we were someone said being fired at. I was sort of excited enough not to notice.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of smoke and haze and some cloud. And we accomplished the drop okay. In fact, we had taken over lead at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And we accomplished the drop and climbed up into the clouds to get away from what they were saying was ground fire. We did have A-1s and we had B-26s flying along with us, and they were, I guess, keeping a lot of the excitement down. But it meant that the troopers, the Vietnamese troops going out of the back of the airplane, were going into contact immediately.
Mm-hmm.
When we finished the mission, we recovered at Tan Sanhut. We were pretty critical on fuel because we had all been sitting around for many hours with engines on, engines off, engines on, engines off,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing, waiting to get to go on the mission. So we recovered. We were all pretty critical on fuel. But we ended up over the club, got together for sort of a post-mission analysis, and it was just, well, it was kind of a fun day, and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We went back to Langley at the end of our TDY there, because we were actually going back to Langley to get ready to PCS over to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided to have a press conference. God knows why. But they decided to get us all together for this sort of press conference, in which we couldn't tell them what we did because we weren't there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it was very confusing. Years later, I found out that we had been recommended for a decoration, but it never occurred because when it got to 315th Air Division, they said, well, we can't, you know, do that because we weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
But that was 40 years later that we found that out. The wing commander at sort of reunion said, yeah, you guys done a good job.
Yes, sir.
And then we just got ready to go back on PCS, and when we PCS'd, permanent change is stationed to the Far East, we went to Mactan Island as a wing. Half our wing went to Mactan, half went to Clark.
Okay.
And that was a short stop because we were supposed to be going on to Utapau, which never happened. And we spent the rest of the time between the Vietnam years, Mactan and Vietnam.
Okay.
And we PCS'd in November of 65.
Okay. All right. Wanted to ask you about, just briefly, about the mission you were talking about, dropping the Arvin troops. A couple more questions about that. What was it, you talked about sitting there with engines on all day. What was it that delayed the mission for so long, or do you know?
I've been told, and this is just an I've been told, it was because Mr. Johnson had not given the final approval, and back there in D.C., everything, final approval for everything had to come out of that, and it was sort of, we were going to go at dawn, and we were all ready to go, and the final word didn't come down, and that's what I've heard as rumor. I don't know if that's a fact or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I know that the B-52s were late getting to do their bombing of the area, and it was fortunate, I guess. They did get written up in Time magazine for dropping bombs, though.
Okay. All right.
As a PAC troop, PAC-AF troop, we did not have great deals of respect for B-52s.
Okay. And why would that be, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, because they were getting medals and they were getting all sorts of press for dropping bombs from 35,000 feet, and they were claiming all sorts of excitement, and I don't think they ever saw a bullet.
Right.
Now, we changed our opinion when they went north.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
When they went up to Hanoi and Haiphong, etc., we certainly respected their mission, but their mission in South Vietnam was to, in our opinion, kill monkeys.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And that's one of those professional jealousies rather than a disrespect for their ability.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This also with this mission with dropping the Arvin troops into to the Michelin plantation. Was this the first time that you knew for sure that you'd come under fire?
I would say yes, it was the first time. And my aircraft commander in later years, we're still close friends,
mm-hmm.
in later years said we had come under fire a number of times that I was totally unaware of because I was busy.
Mm-hmm.
And in a 130, even though you're looking out the window and you're doing things during the last few minutes of flight, you're pretty busy, and so I never noticed.
Mm-hmm.
The times I knew I was under fire is when we got hit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's see. I definitely want to talk to you about that a little more later on. But when you were PCS'd to Asia, when you were finally moved over permanent, was it with the same crew and the same plane?
Yes.
Okay. So
in fact, it was, just an aside, my wife was 7 months pregnant when we PCS'd,
okay.
and I was given a choice of staying home until after she had the baby,
mm-hmm.
or going with my crew. And since I had been crewed with these guys for a couple of years, we knew each other very well. My wife and I talked it over and said, you know, chances of surviving with somebody you knew and trusted was probably better in the long run. So I chose to go, and she stayed, you know, she had the baby while I was over there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
But yes, I had been flying with these guys for a couple of years, and we were pretty close.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Okay. All right. So, when was it again that you arrived?
We PCS'd in November of 1965.
Okay, right.
By that time, we were pretty combat savvy, I guess you'd want to call it, because we'd been over there in 63, 64, and 65 in temporary duty status.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. And in your questionnaire, I noticed that you mentioned various different types of missions that you were flying to this, the airdrops, air assault, troop hauling, air evac, and stuff like that. Could you talk about some of those different types of missions you were flying and just tactics involved in those and that type of thing?
Okay, the air assaults were when we took the combat troops and air-landed them into a zone. The zone might be cold, it might be hot.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, the runway conditions were very primitive, anywhere from mud and dirt to this sort of plastic runways they used to PSP and occasionally actual concrete. But typically, they were into areas where we had 1,000 feet, give or take, of runway space.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were so tight that only one airplane at a time actually went in, and the rest of us hung around in orbit. And as the aircraft offloaded and took off, the next airplane would go in. Some of them had little ramp space off to the side, so we would go in and offload and then turn around and go off. We rarely ever shut down an engine.
Mm-hmm.
Engines just stayed running. And the troops were more than, I guess, fairly often they were engaged. I took troops into the Ashall Valley.
Okay.
Took them directly from a point where they landed at Quinyon into the Ashall and directly into combat.
Mm-hmm.
And the air assault missions were, like I say, taking troops and equipment, dropping it into either hot or cold zones, offloading them typically off the ramp.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of times I can remember down in the Mekong Delta, we were being mortared while the troops and stuff was being rolled off the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
The mortars were exploding, so we were excited to get out of there. We didn't want to stay.
Sure, yes, sir.
Airdrops. We did not do a lot of airdropping. I guess I did two or three, maybe four troop airdrops during my year and a half over there. And a couple of times we dropped Vietnamese, well, I shouldn't say three or four, but three or four assaults. A couple of times we dropped Vietnamese, and in some cases we dropped whole families. And I mean literally mama, papa, the chickens, the hogs, everybody went out. I spent some time as an advisor on the ground, a semi-forward air controller.
Okay.
And one period of time it was with a Vietnamese unit. There was myself and a Marine who was their, I guess, permanent advisor. And we wandered around Vietnam, and there were a lot of times that people didn't want to take us anywhere because they'd look at it and say, well, you've got not only troops, but you've got mamas and papas and wives and everything else. I said, yeah, that's the way we move. I didn't experience any negatives with when I was assigned to that job.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you're talking stories about, you know, people not wanting to jump or not wanting to go here or not wanting to go there. I've heard all those stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not personally experience that. When we moved from I Corps down to 3 Corps, there was no reluctance. They just moved because that's what they were told to do. Out in the field, I didn't find that the couple of times we were actually engaged in a combat mission, I didn't find any difficulty in the people I was associated with. So, again, I've heard the stories. I don't have a personal complaint.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
You still there?
Yes, sir.
I can't hardly hear you.
I'm sorry.
Hold on. Maybe it's my phone. Hold
okay.
On. How's this?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
I'm still having difficulty hearing you.
Okay. Let's see.
I guess.
Okay.
On air evacs, we went in and picked up, you know, the wounded and the deceased and took them back to Tan Snu, took them to Da Nang, took them to Cameron Bay, or in some cases we had an emergency of a young man who had his kidneys destroyed by, I guess, grenade fragments. We flew him up to Tachikawa.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of liked Garivac because I thought we were doing a really important job.
Sure.
I always felt good at the end where I found out, you know, that we kept some young man alive or some group of young people,
mm-hmm.
got them to a medical facility to take care of them. Cargo missions, in some cases we would fly 8, 10, 12 sorties a day, just we called ourselves cheap airlines in those days because all we were doing was we'd start off at Tan Snu, we'd fly to, you know, whatever field we were going to and drop off stuff, go to someplace else, pick up stuff, go somewhere else, drop it off, and this would just go on day after day after day.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days, in early 65, I'm sorry, late 65, early 66, we had people, we were flying so heavily, you know, people were logging 150, 160 hours a month, which was beyond the Air Force allowable norms.
Okay.
And they were getting waivers. On the 25th of February here in the United States, I remember the day because my son was born that day. One of our crews, we were sitting in the, I don't know what to call them, they were sort of a temporary hooch.
Mm-hmm.
But we were sitting there, and they were sending this one crew out, and the aircraft commander stopped by to talk to me. And we were good friends. He said, you know, I just can't keep doing this. I can't keep doing this. And he was very nervous. And he hit the top of the hill up at On K. Fortunately, they all survived.
Mm.
And it generated a sort of investigation. Margaret Chase Smith, who was his congressman, came out, and she seemed very unhappy. Apparently, he had written to her. But it became apparent that the air crews were being stressed, I think much like today, where you just work and work and work and work with no breaks, but it was necessary. I mean, that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
But people were becoming tired, and people were becoming their own worst enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But as 66 moved into the spring, we got more crews coming out of the states, either PCS or TDY, and the pressure started to get relieved.
Okay.
Mm. And things actually got, you know, much more pleasant.
Okay. All right. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned about a little earlier about in the airdrops and stuff, that you whole families and, you know, the husbands and the wives and the children and everything. Why would the families be involved in this? Kind of like a camp family kind of following the military, or?
Yeah, it was the old camp follower sort
okay.
of thing. And they would often, if you were moving a unit, and I don't know their designations, but if you were moving a unit, they all moved together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because they were permanently moving them somewhere. They came aboard with their chickens and their hogs.
Okay. All right. Did you ever move or airdrop Americans? Or was it mostly?
Yes, I did.
Okay. All right.
And I did also get a chance to move around some of the Australians.
Okay.
Americans, I think I dropped twice.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to look back at my logbook for sure, but they were both down in the southern end of the country. One was down in the Vong Tau region, and the other was over off by the Delta.
Okay. You mentioned in the questionnaire, you talked specifically about a few of the airdrops with Operation Hastings in Birmingham. Could you talk a little bit about those?
Time frame?
let's see.
You know, every operation had a name.
Uh-huh, sure.
And unfortunately, we're 45 years away.
Right, sure. Okay.
And I know when I filled out the questionnaire, I had my logbook, and I was going through it to try to keep track. They were typically putting the Army in so that the Army could engage the Viet Cong, the forces there. And the typical day there would be essentially start off early in the morning, load them up, take them out, put them in or drop them,
mm-hmm.
and then just return and keep doing that day after day after day.
Okay.
Let's see. 65. See if I can find anything there.
It's all right. You don't have to worry about it.
Okay. No, I could, you know, if I knew the sort of date again, I pulled out of the logbook, but not having the date is kind of hard.
Sure. Yes, sir. All right. Okay. Another thing I wanted to ask you about was if you could just talk about the quarters and the food and that type of thing while you were in country.
I think my crew was very fortunate. Occasionally, we lived on Tonsonute in tents during the early 65 rotations, 1965 rotations. After we were PCS'd over to MAC-10 and operating in Vietnam on a regular basis, our crew lived in Cho Lan in a hotel, the old Mercury Hotel.
Okay.
And actually, I considered that to be pretty decent living compared to how people lived, you know, in a lot of the rest of the place.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the air crews lived in contract villas, and they were probably one step down. And if you're out in the field, if you were away from Tonsonute or away from Da Nang, a couple of those places, you often lived in the airplane.
Okay.
Or tents. Actually, living in Vietnam was better than living on MAC-10, because in MAC-10 we lived in tents.
Okay.
Sanitarily speaking, Vietnam was not a very sanitary country by Western standards.
Mm-hmm.
We had garbage, you know, the toilet facilities were not what we're accustomed to, but we became accustomed to theirs. Eating-wise, when we weren't flying, we sometimes ate at the military mess, sometimes ate at the officer's club, but more often than not, we ate on the economy at the local bistros in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
When we were flying, eating was almost unknown. We didn't have any facility, essentially. Even though the airplane had the ability to cook something, the only thing we had to cook was sea rations.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ate, when we were out working, out flying, if you ate, you ate sea rats.
Okay.
Some better than others.
All right. Yes, sir.
I guess our favorite was the pound cake.
Right. All right. Let's see. You talked about some of the guys living in these villas and all. You mentioned something about in the questionnaire, a memorable moment about a VC shooting from a building that you were near or something?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
We were sitting outside the Mercury Hotel.
Okay.
And we were drinking a bomby bomb or two.
Mm-hmm.
And there was our crew and Major Richardson's crew, and all of a sudden the VC decided to attack the villa right next to us.
Okay.
It was a military villa, and I guess it was a poor choice because the villa actually had armed guards, and it became a matter of the VC trying to throw a hand grenade in while the armed guards were chewing them up with whatever their weapons were, M16s or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they really cut this poor dude down.
Mm-hmm.
And Major Richardson, who was well into his bomby bomb, walked out into the street, essentially, and walked up to this poor dead guy. Looked back over at the guy who shot him and said, "Hey, I missed that. Will you want to do that again?" And I know that's sick humor, but unfortunately, at that point in our lives, sick humor often was a relief for stress.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Short time after that, or I guess I think it was right after that short time, the VC did load the front of the caisson mess hall off, and that was just up the street from us.
Mm-hmm.
They hit it with one of those shaped bombs full of little marbles.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was not there, obviously.
Right. Yes, sir.
At the time.
All right. That brings up another question that I wanted to ask you about. While you were on the ground at some of these air bases and things. Did the VC ever attack the bases while you were there?
I was on Tansanute once when the VC tried to make a attack on the base, and they were this psychological stuff with, you know, American die, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into lights out and onto a combat footing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember any mortars or anything hitting us at the time, but we decided that someplace else would be a better place to be than where we were at, so we went out and cranked up our airplane and left.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, we had the authority to do that.
Yes, sir.
A couple other times, there were incidents. Now, when I was a forward air controller with the 173rd, I was on the ground when we were attacked.
Okay.
And it was one of those incidences where they almost overran us.
Oh, wow.
I was working with the 173rd as the Air Force liaison up at Bodot.
Mm-hmm.
And we were essentially surrounded. We had just a pocket of troops. And I was able to get a hold of a 130 who volunteered to come in. I wasn't sure whether I should let him come in. In fact, I told him kind of not to come in because the VC actually held the runway. And he brought the 130 in, and we evacuated the troops without the airplane really ever stopping. It just rolled by, and the troops got out of their holes, and we all jumped aboard.
Mm-hmm.
The airplane suffered significant damage both from the airfield and from the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into a very close encounter with some VC. It was kill or be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll leave it there.
Yes, sir. All right. let's see. How about, you mentioned later on, on some of the missions that you were flying, I know we talked about that first flight where you came under fire and sort of in 64. But what about other times? Was your plane ever hit while you were on missions?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, I have a certificate, and it was kind of a humor thing with us if you survived them. I have a certificate called the Order of the Wounded Hercules, and it was the first time we knowingly got hit up at think on K or one of those places, but in any case, we took fire. We had a couple of wounded on board. Nobody was killed or badly injured, but the 315th Air Division actually gave us these really neat certificates. It's the one thing I keep on the wall. But that was the first time. We had our hydraulics shot away at Quinyon, and that was kind of a strange incident. They not only got us, they got a sampan out in the bay.
Okay.
Apparently had a automatic weapon on it. And we were coming in behind a 123, and the sampan managed to stitch the 123 and got us. And we lost all our hydraulics, so we had a rather exciting landing. And again, our humor was sort of sick because as we got to the end of the runway and rolled off, the flight engineer or loadmaster, I don't remember which, got out a little can of spray paint. And this was the time when all the cigarette warnings were first going on packages. The Surgeon General says, you know, cigarettes are bad for your health.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this little spray can that we used to carry around so we could make little spray can marks of green weasels on other airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote on the side of the airplane, he said, Surgeon General says VC bullets are hazardous to your health.
Mm-hmm.
And although we thought that was pretty funny, our squadron commander didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
she thought maybe painting the side of the airplane like that was a bad idea.
Right.
Mind you, they would get on us for stupid stuff like that, but they weren't particularly harsh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the environment was such that they just kind of ignored half of what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was talking about these little spray cans, the reason they had them was we had little stencils of green weasels, which was our squadron animal.
Okay.
And if you got into a strange base, if you could get over to one of the Army helicopters or one of the tanks, crew chiefs and loadmasters would typically stencil a green weasel on the side of their tank or on the side of their helicopter just to let them know we've been there.
Right. All right. Okay.
But there were three times I know for sure that our airplane was hit. And you know by the sound, it makes a funny sound coming through the aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it tended to make a sound in the headsets.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess with all the missions that you were flying everywhere, I assumed you flew over South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia.
Uh-huh.
Which of these would you say had the most dangerous airspace, or was there a difference?
Airspace-wise, South Vietnam was the most dangerous airspace.
Mm-hmm.
And not only from the standpoint of having bad guys there, but there was so much traffic and so much of it was uncontrolled.
Mm-hmm.
We would fly off and just at the base of the clouds, and all of a sudden there'd be another airplane. You go, oh, where the heck did he come from?
Oh, wow.
And we had some near misses. One was exciting. We had a CV-2, I don't remember what they were, not the buffalo, the caribou. All of a sudden there was a caribou and us, and it looked like we were going to hit each other, but, you know, we missed.
Right.
But the airspace was just so crowded day and night, and truly there was nobody in full control of it because the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, everybody operating,
mm-hmm.
and we were operating essentially VFR in less than VFR conditions.
Yes, sir. All right.
Cambodia was, I never had anything happen while we were over there or Laos that, you know, was that big a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I mentioned it, but we flew a few missions up north.
Okay.
And I did have a MiG chase me one day.
Oh, wow.
I did manage to violate the DMZ because the rules of engagement said that we weren't allowed to fly through it, but when Big Eye told us we had a fast mover on our tail and he wasn't friendly, we chose to fly straight to Da Nang where there was air interceptors rather than fly out over the coast.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sir.
We didn't fly. I never flew far north. I went up to a place called Vin.
Okay, yes, sir. I know where Vin is.
And, again, we couldn't count those missions because
mm-hmm.
we weren't there.
Right. Would these have been recon missions?
They were basically recon. Well, we were tracking the building of some missile sites.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the rules of engagement said you couldn't attack a missile site until they became operational.
Right.
And we called it trolling. We'd fly up and see if they were ready to come online. And when they did come online, the F-4s went in and took them offline.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I don't know why they used 130s. One time we got together with some F-4 guys. They thought we were actually electronic countermeasures airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't.
Right, yes, sir.
But I guess they had been told that ECM was up there, and we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
We were just waiting to find out when the stuff was operational so they could go in and attack it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't remember the exact number. I think I flew north 19 times.
Okay. what would be the standard tactic, I guess, for if the SAM sites did turn on and then did lock on to you?
We slowed down.
Slowed down, okay.
Yeah, the SA-2, at least we were told the SA-2 would not engage you below 170 or 180 knots, so if we saw a SAM raising on the thing, we just drag it down to 130 knots and drop down to the deck and run like hell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, you had an altitude thing there, too. And I don't remember what the SA-2 altitude was, but we get right on the treetops.
Mm-hmm.
And once we were on the treetops, of course, we'd accelerate.
Right. Okay.
And the 130 was capable of about 250 indicated on the deck.
Outside of the SAMs, what type of anti-aircraft and stuff did the enemy employ?
They had lots, but I don't know that we were ever shot at anything larger than maybe a 37 millimeter.
Okay.
I mean, I've seen, you know, we had flak on one or two occasions, but it wasn't the stuff I remember from World War II movies where you had the, you know, big explosion, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so I would say it was essentially they had a 37 mil. I would guess it was probably that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, you mentioned about 19 or so missions over the north. How about how many missions would you estimate that you've flied over, say, Laos and Cambodia?
Just a few over Cambodia.
Okay.
I flew into Laos, maybe a dozen. Let's see, Laos. I probably went into Laos about 20 to 25 times.
Mm-hmm. Would this be dropping equipment?
Mostly it was taking the equipment in and landing at some of their bases.
Okay.
Air America flew a lot of stuff out there, and we often supplied Air America out of Vientiane or some of their satellite fields.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. How about civic action programs and things like that? Did you ever participate in any of those?
We built a couple of schools, got the wives back home to get people to donate books and things like that. We collectively being the squadron and the wing,
mm-hmm.
we built things in the Philippines, we built things in Vietnam.
Okay.
Sanitary facilities. It was sort of an off-duty thing. We built a fairly large community building. I wasn't particularly involved in it, but some of the guys who weren't able to fly, if they were grounded for any medical reason temporarily, they got to be on the building crews.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about what other types of activities whenever you were not on duty?
We drank a lot.
Okay. All right.
When we weren't on duty, generally, we were trying to get some sleep,
mm-hmm.
Do a little drinking, and recover.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually, in country, we worked a fairly heavy schedule,
mm-hmm.
so there wasn't a lot of free time.
Right. Okay. All right. You talked a little bit about this earlier, of course, but I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your job as a FAC and how you got involved with that, and just a little bit about the duties that entailed.
I got involved. Normally, what we did was they had typically assigned a pilot to some of the outfits as FACs, air liaisons.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in SEG. I was a flight evaluator.
Okay.
And my aircraft commander was one of those who was chosen as the air liaison FAC thing. And Colonel Bridges, who was our deputy wing commander, came up to me and just basically said, he said, Frank, I need somebody, and I don't have anyone else. Congratulations, you're going out with the 173rd.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined the 173rd as forward air controller, air liaison, and my job was I had a Jeep with a bunch of radios.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy that Air Force controller that worked with me, and we were attached to the 173rd for a period of time, and what we did was coordinate with them the air assault airplanes coming in or the drop stuff coming in to resupply them.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially we're nothing more than a part of the grunt force.
Right. Yes, sir.
And lived in foxholes and tents and all those good fun things. That's where I got involved with the thing at Bodot.
Right.
And then I went from the 173rd to a Vietnamese, and I guess they were Vietnamese Marines,
mm-hmm.
because I had a Marine, American Marine, as my co-advisor. He was basically the advisor to the Marine, the Vietnamese, and I was just along for the ride to coordinate and control the supplying and moving the Vietnamese around.
Okay.
And I did that, I don't remember how long, but it was a unique experience in the fact that I got a chance to live and experience what the Army, the grunts on the ground got to do rather than just the Air Force experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And there were exciting moments.
Mm-hmm.
Bullets in the air and bullets on the ground are considerably different.
Mm-hmm.
In the air, if they hit the airplane, you notice it. But on the ground, when people are shooting at you, you do know it because you hear it, and the results are much more personal.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I only had a couple of engagements in my time where I could say that, you know, we were actually in a firefight, but I certainly would not have wanted to spend a ground tour with the Marines or the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys had it really rough.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that brings up one of the questions, kind of answered it in saying that, but I wanted to ask you, was working with the guys on the ground, did it kind of change your perspective on the war?
Oh, yes. We in the Air Force really, in the words of some other people, had it made.
Mm-hmm.
Because we worked all day, but at the end of the day, you essentially recovered to a fairly safe, fairly secure area. The Army just, those guys, the Army Marines, on and on and on, the dirt and the filth that they lived in and the conditions and the dangers day to day, I just can't imagine how they survived their tours, you know, and came home in any sort of shape at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was just totally amazing. One of the things that we did as air crew, because we worked with the Army, being in C-130s, you worked with the Army regularly. And I think as a cadre, we had built up a great deal of respect for them. So if we went into the Philippines, what we typically did, and this was with the, you know, good graces of our wing commander, we would buy up case after case after case of San Miguel beer.
Mm-hmm.
And we would stack it in the airplane. If we knew we were going back in country, we'd stack it in the airplane. And as we'd fly into an Army base, we would often put on a little show for the Army. We'd stick a white sheet or sort of a tablecloth on the ramp,
mm-hmm.
and then go sit on the ramp and put a bottle of beer on the ramp and look at the Army and say, guys, don't you wish you were in the Air Force? Whereupon you would get a bunch of very angry grunts.
Right.
And we would typically get a hold of their first shirt, whoever was in charge of them, and say, look, Sarge, we have 20, 30, 40, 50, whatever cases of San Miguel on board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all we ask is that you know, reimburse, and sometimes we didn't even ask that, just reimburse us for the cost of the San Miguel.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a nickel a bottle, so it was pretty damn cheap.
Right.
They would have paid much more than a nickel a bottle for it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But they just became so used to, here's those damn fools in the 130 sitting on their show, and we know we're going to get a little San Miguel out of this. So they would dump off whatever number of cases.
Right.
At one point, I had 121 cases of booze.
Oh, wow.
That I took in.
Yeah.
Oh, hell. They deserved it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure they were very appreciative, too.
They were very accommodating if we needed sea rations or boots or whatever.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. When you worked with the Vietnamese, I wanted to ask you, going back to our conversation earlier about the Vietnamese and your opinion of them, did working more closely with them, did that change your opinion or affect your opinion of them at all?
Not particularly.
Okay.
My communications were essentially limited to the few who spoke English and to the interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
I did not disrespect them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't fully understand why they needed to move their wives and children and chickens and hogs, but I guess I did in the long term because it was how they lived.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, I was sort of opinionated. I guess I would have tended from the stories to have had less respect for him, but working with him, I had a little more respect for him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I particularly got to know a few who had been actually lived up in the Hanoi area before they had moved south,
mm-hmm.
and I had a great deal of respect for them because we could communicate, obviously, and they seemed very happy that we were there to help them. They seemed genuinely glad we were there. And I've heard stories where a lot of people say, well, you know, maybe we didn't need to be there. Maybe that's true. But my experience, limited as it was in that respect, was they seemed to want us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that when we left a horrible residual taste in their mouth,
mm-hmm.
because we left them down after, you know, building them up.
Right.
And I worked up in the Hmong area a little bit. And again, I couldn't communicate with them, but I found they were very, at least through their advisors, through the guys who were in the A-teams and that, they really liked working with them. And in later life, I learned that, you know, we really screwed those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Promised them all sorts of things and then didn't deliver, which bothered me because when I joined the Air Force, I was an idealist.
Yes, sir.
I believed in American pie, you know, apple pie, hot dogs, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Vietnam as an idealist. It wasn't until later, after the war was over, etc., that I became less enamored with what we were doing.
Okay.
In fact, after the war, for a long time, I didn't have much to say about it. And what brought me out of even thinking about the war and our involvement was I actually took a course in, I don't know what they call it, Vietnam War history or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And got involved with people who were teaching it who had never been there, had never, you know, experienced Vietnam, and we got into some very long discussions. In fact, one of the people teaching it was a friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Jerry Sweeney up at South Dakota State University.
Okay.
And at the end of the course, I wrote him a 70 or 80 page sort of critique on what they were teaching and what my experiences were.
Mm-hmm.
And much of what was in there was, you know, guys, from a historical standpoint, when you're standing off from afar, you see the big picture.
Right.
Now, the big picture for me was whatever I could see from the airplane or the 75 yards on the ground, and it was a whole lot different.
Mm. Yes, sir.
Especially, there's nothing more horrible than putting body bags on an airplane or picking them up out of the field, bringing them in to consummate the recovery area, or going out on the flight line and seeing all the aluminum caskets waiting to be loaded on a C-135 or one of the airplanes going back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing that will erase that from my memory.
Right.
Those young kids, you know, their lives were cut short, and then we didn't do anything to finalize or save the country in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It was very discouraging later on. When I think about these young kids today over in Iraq and Afghanistan, my own daughter and son-in-law have both been over there.
Okay.
I get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Not for their lives particularly. I know they're doing their job, but I get nervous as to whether we're going to walk out on them again or whether we're going to do the job we supposedly were going to do. I really loved the first Iraq war with President Bush. He did the job he said he was going to do and then left.
Right.
I'm not sure I was that pleased with W.
Mm, yes,
and I'm Republican.
All right. Well, this is something...
I shouldn't have got off in that time.
No, not at all. Actually, towards the end of the interview, that was some of the things that I did want to touch on with you, if you were... it's one of the some of the questions I like to ask about your opinion on the war.
Okay.
I definitely want to touch on this a little bit more with you later on. But we've come to about 2 hours here now.
Uh-huh.
Would you mind if we stop it here and then pick up again at a later date?
Oh, no.
Okay.
My memory will fail me a little bit on what we talked about. No, that's okay.
Okay. Well, I will go ahead and stop the recording, rather. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with retired Air Force Major Francis Goel. Today is March 6, 2009. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Goel is joining me by phone once again from Lebanon, Ohio. All right. Sorry for interrupting you.
Okay.
If you don't mind, okay, you can go ahead and tell me what you were saying before.
Okay. I just condensed some things down to sort of a review. But I like I say, I flew combat or combat support missions on 235 days.
Okay.
Completed 552 sorties.
Okay.
The aircraft we were shot up on 4 missions.
Okay.
Did 16 combat airdrops, 12 personnel and 4 cargo.
Okay.
We flew 244 what we called air assault sorties, 43 of them into hot assault zones, hot being contested.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And we talked about Birmingham. I looked up Birmingham in my log, and in 11 days there, in what I think what I did was probably typical, I flew 64 sorties.
Okay.
And that was because we had mentioned Birmingham for some reason. I went and looked it up.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Actually, we got hit twice on that in Birmingham.
Okay. 64 sorties for, you said 11 days?
In 11 days, yeah.
Is that a pretty high number?
Yeah, that's a high number, but it was typical of that type of operation.
Okay.
We had things that they called TACEs, T-A-C, letter E.
Mm-hmm.
And those were where we had emergencies. The Army needed resupply, or the Marines needed resupply, and they needed it now. And they were typically into hot zones.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of tackies during Birmingham. And what would happen is you'd go into Tonsonute, or you'd go into one of the major bases. You'd load up the troops or load up equipment real fast, fly it out. Because in Vietnam, most flights were pretty short.
Okay.
And you'd fly out to the landing zone. You'd land. We typically didn't turn off the engines. You'd just offload the cargo and the troops, take off and go back and get another load.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess most of the time in those sort of things, you were sometimes in orbit waiting to find space down on the ground, because typically they didn't have a lot of cargo offload room or troop offload room, so you often did it just on the runway.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. Yes, sir. All right. So when you say 64 sorties, would that be each time you land and unload the material, would that be a sortie?
That would be a sortie, yeah.
Okay. All right. Yes, sir. All right. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about last time that I meant to, you mentioned about being a flight evaluator.
Right.
And we didn't talk too much about that. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about that.
Being a flight evaluator was a job where I checked out the other navigators,
mm-hmm.
as to their qualifications, as to their proficiencies. And in the peacetime Air Force, we typically, as a navigator, you had a 60-1 check, which was a overwater flight long-term where you did celestial and used all the different navigation systems that you're supposed to know how to use.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had what was called a 60-2 or a tactical check, which was either physically air refueling in the refueling squadrons or dropping troops or doing low level and dropping heavy equipment. And you would do one every 6 months.
Okay.
And pretty typical, I guess, even in the airlines today, they have check pilots, check navs, and they do essentially the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, because we didn't have the availability of just free airplanes, I actually did the flight evaluations on combat missions.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So if a navigator needed a check ride or if he needed training, you know, the new kids coming in country, like all of us, the first few times you're in there, you're a bit of trepidation of what you're doing and where you're going to do it,
mm-hmm.
and I would fly with them just give them a chance to see what it was and relax and have somebody to talk to if there was a question.
Right. So they were getting some real on-the-job training then.
Yeah, it was real world.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Did you find that most everyone was up to standard?
Yeah.
Okay.
We didn't actually, we didn't really tolerate somebody who wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
If I found somebody on a check ride who was not qualified or didn't meet the qualifications, I would fly with him as an instructor for whatever time it took to get him back up to speed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And typically that was not more than one or two missions.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, before we move on to post-Vietnam, is there anything else we need to cover? Is there anything we have not covered at this point?
Probably the fact that typical C-130s also had a base out of country.
Okay.
We were stationed, physically stationed at either Utapau, Mactan, Clark, Okinawa, Xinjiang Kwan up in Taiwan.
Right.
That would be where your mail went.
Okay.
You weren't there, but your mail was.
Okay.
And then we would rotate in-country for 15 to 45 days, and then you'd rotate out of country for 2 or 3 days. And this was a political thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because by doing that, the government was able to say that we weren't there.
Right.
The airplanes were stationed at an address, and for what it was worth, that's how it worked.
Mm-hmm. And how often would you rotate back to these more permanent bases?
Typically, you'd go back there for a day or two. You'd be in country for 15
mm-hmm.
to 45 days. You'd go back out to either Mactan or wherever your organization was for a day or two.
Okay.
And then you'd rotate back in to Vietnam.
Uh-huh. All right.
And like I say, it was a political ploy, and that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. You mentioned your that would be where your mail would come to. Would it then be forwarded to Vietnam, or would you always have to go back?
No. It just hung
okay.
over there. I got all sorts of information totally out of sequence from my family at home.
Right, sure. All right. Let's see. And were there, was there one in particular that, that you were based at more than others, or were you rotated?
Well, my mail address was Mactan Island.
Okay, that's right. You mentioned that last time. All right.
And actually, we had worse living conditions there than we did in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Okay. Well, let's see. I can't remember exactly what we covered last time, but I think we covered Vietnam pretty well.
Probably,
last time.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. So I guess if there's nothing else, then at that point we can move on, unless there's anything else you think we need
I
to cover.
I honestly can't think of anything. Like okay. I say, I had a pretty typical tour duty.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, when did you receive orders to rotate out?
I rotated out on the 11th of November, 1966.
Okay.
I got my orders probably a couple of weeks before that. They actually asked me if I'd like to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And after having spent 19 months in Vietnam, you know, through the TDYs and the PCS, and having a young son that I had not seen, he was born 3 months into my tour, and quite frankly because I was tired, I said no.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. At what point did you stop flying?
Stop flying what? Physically?
I guess stop flying missions, or stop going into Vietnam.
Oh, the day I left.
The day you left. Okay, so up until that point, still going into Vietnam. Okay.
I was in Vietnam. I left Vietnam on a one of the road birds going back to Mactan. I didn't even bother packing.
Okay.
And got to Mactan and picked up an airplane that was headed back to the States. We went on to Midway Island and then on into California.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there any sort of out processing?
Yeah, we out processed, but it was pretty cut and dried, you know.
Okay.
Turning your stuff that you have and sign this paper and say sayonara.
Uh-huh. Right, right. When you left Vietnam at that point in time, how did you feel about how the war was going at that point?
Actually, in 1966, we were progressing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
At least it appeared we were progressing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't even get into the politics of whether, you know, what we should have done post that or not. But much of what proceeded when I left was political.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when we get to the end of the interview, I would like to ask you a little bit about your opinions on how things progressed and your opinion on the war in general and how it was handled. But I know you mentioned a little bit about it last time, but anyway, let's see. Well, how was your reception whenever you returned to the States? Was everything still pretty calm at that point?
For the typical person coming back, I think it was somewhat dramatic. The peace movement or the protest had begun, but I flew from Midway or Wake. I'm not sure that I remember exactly, but I flew into California, and I flew in on military C-130. I got off the airplane with two or three of us. We were being transferred to Mather Air Force Base in California.
Okay.
We got there in the middle of the night. Nobody was there to greet us.
Mm-hmm.
And we just essentially filtered back in. So having done that and going to a military base, we didn't run into the protest groups that happened to be, you know, at the commercial sort of fields.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
And I think there was still a fairly positive attitude of the public in that point in 66. I don't think the protest movement had gotten that strong. It was building, but it hadn't gotten, you know, really, really nasty.
Right, right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, did you have any time off to spend with your family before your next assignment?
I went directly to my next assignment.
Okay.
And my family, they joined us out in California.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was your next assignment?
Nav training at Mather Air Force Base. I went back as an instructor nav.
All right. Was there any period of adjustment to going from combat flight situations in Vietnam to this next assignment?
Personal adjustments? Yes, there were many.
Okay.
Literally, I drank a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that probably many other people did, too. I had a wife who was unbelievably understanding, and she put up with that. But, you know, it tapered off. But, again, being in a military environment, not having gone through or trying to meld into a civilian society again, I didn't run into a lot of outside pressures, and we were not only welcome back at the military bases, since I was training new navigators, they were pretty in awe of us guys coming out of combat.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as a personal thing, no, I didn't have great trepidation or great problems.
Okay.
Other than the drinking I still was doing from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I had trouble sleeping. I used to wake up in the middle of the night, cold sweats, that sort of thing. But, you know, it all went away.
Uh-huh. Right. Yes, sir. All right. Training these new navigators, did you base a lot of your training on telling them, say, well, this is what you need to expect when going to Vietnam? And also, did they ask a lot of questions about Vietnam?
The answer to both is yes. They asked a lot of questions because, you know, they realized that was going to be in their probably immediate future.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, we did quite heavily the way we taught navigators because back in what we called the world, the people in the hierarchies still were looking at the way we used to do things, and we were coming back and saying, well, that may be how you used to do things, but that's not how we're doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably a thing that exists even today. You know, people out in the field do things, and us old guys remember how we used to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But once we convinced the leaders, the colonels, et cetera, that we needed to prepare the young people for things. There were significant changes in the training programs.
Right. Could you give me an example of some of the changes that would have been made? Do you know of any specific ones?
Okay. When I went through training, primarily we trained for flying transcontinental, transoceanic.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the primary things we were doing.
Right.
As we looked at the combat environment, we were doing a lot of low-level short flights, not as much of the electronics or the celestial, but more of the radar and map reading and time distance sort of things. And so the training program went heavily toward what we call the high-speed, low-level map reading type things so that it wouldn't be new to them when they went through combat crew training and then on into Vietnam.
Right.
So it significantly changed, and in fact, they even introduced putting the navigators near the end of their training into a T-37 with a pilot and a student and flying low level in a jet, which was something we had never done before.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And to your knowledge, did this, I'm sure it did, but did it improve their performance greatly?
I can only hazard the guess that it probably saved a lot of kids, mm-hmm. a lot of lives, and did, in fact, make them much more competent.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, how long were you at this assignment?
I was at Mather from November of 66 till July of 69. I spent a great deal of time in the hospital.
Okay.
I had a bunch of internal parasites that opened up into ulcerations, and
mm.
I spent about 3 months hospitalized in that tour.
Mm-hmm. Goodness. Right. All right. Well, as you were here at this tour from 66 to 69, did you pay close attention to the war and see how things were beginning to start to decline at that point?
Yeah, we, you know, obviously being in the military and actually expecting to go back because it was typical,
mm-hmm.
You paid close attention to what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And again, from an Air Force standpoint, our success rates, at least we thought, you know, we're making a real inroad.
Mm-hmm.
The Tet thing that came up in, what, 68, I guess?
Yes, sir.
Was a tactical, I guess, victory, but a political terrific loss.
Mm-hmm, right.
And, you know, a lot of that was just basically something the Orientals loved. We lost face.
Right. Right.
Yeah, so it you know, it changed the whole outlook of how things were going to go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Did you notice any change in morale among within the Air Force itself as things began to change in Vietnam?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we were not only going through the Vietnam thing, we were also going through the integration of the black community into mainstream society,
mm-hmm.
and that impacted on the military. Even though the military had been integrated, it still did impact.
Mm-hmm.
And as the war became unpopular, it started to become an unpopular forecast within the military.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the officer corps navigators, they were still pretty positive, pretty up. But a lot of the enlisted people who support, you know, the whole program, because without them you can't run the program.
Sure.
And a lot of them were getting tired of the constant go back to Vietnam for a second tour or a third tour or whatever, and see that the political system was not supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
So the knowledge of not being supported and the outcry from the civilian community did have a pretty dramatic effect on the troops, per se.
Right. Okay. All right. You mentioned integration and issues with that. Do you mind, or would you mind talking about, if you remember, were there any specific racial problems that came to mind that you could talk about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Starting even before Vietnam, back when I was in tankers, it was early 60s. I had a black co-pilot,
mm-hmm.
and we went to many places, south, north. The young man was receiving death threats. Because we rode to work together, we received death threats.
Mm-hmm.
The South did not really want to integrate. You know, obviously, that's not news.
Mm-hmm.
So in some cases, they just harassed the young troops if they went off base. And the military being supposedly integrated didn't mean we still didn't have people who didn't believe in it.
Right.
And would make it difficult for particularly the blacks. We didn't have much of a Hispanic community in that time.
Mm-hmm.
But they would make it difficult for the blacks. And they would, you know, purposely set up roadblocks to their promotions and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I was down at Selma when Dr. King had the march. We went down there because we took the military police unit in, so we were down there for the marches and
mm-hmm.
for the riots, etc. And I had some very close friends who were very strong. These were Navigator friends who were very, very strong on integration, and they ran into problems because of their ideas, again, with some of the commanders who weren't exactly integration-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Over in the combat zone, you want to talk about integration working? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In the combat zone, most of us didn't care what color you were as long as you were doing your job.
Right. Yes, sir.
So it was kind of a... Okay, mm-hmm. The color line is gone.
Right. Okay. How would the black airmen respond to, you mentioned, like, troubles in the South and on being harassed? How would they respond to that? Did they keep it to themselves, keep it inside, or how did they respond?
In the beginning, they didn't respond. As the integration movement started to take hold, they did respond.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have sessions of understanding the integration, understanding race relations sort of sessions. But they started to protest, and they started to back up and say, no, we're not going to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, rightly so.
Right.
So it did create, again, stresses and problems. You know, one of the problems, which will sound stupid in today's world, but hair became an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Hair became a very large issue. The blacks wanted their ethnic hair,
mm-hmm.
Which was beyond what the military manual said you could have. And then all of a sudden, the white guys decided they wanted longer hair, too.
Right.
And it's dumb, but hair became a very, very driving issue in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really not hair as much as it was the acceptance of integration, the acceptance of the individual as a part of the whole.
Mm-hmm. Right, yes, sir. All right. How about the assassination of Dr. King? Did that create? I imagine it did. But were there issues that came up as a result of that in the Air Force?
With the assassination, not only of Dr. King, but of Robert Kennedy and of the president.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yeah, those created very stressful points, not only within the integration, but just within what's going to happen next. You know, all of a sudden we're being ruled by one man, one gun,
mm-hmm.
rather than the democracy that most of us as idealists believed in.
Right, yes, sir.
And so we got somewhat heady about that, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
There was a backlash in some of the military community, but I think more in the Army and Marine Corps than in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Air Force probably did, at least in the beginning, the best job of integrating and acceptance,
okay.
as opposed to what we perceive the Army and Marine Corps to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would there be a reason for that? A specific reason why the Air Force would have done a better job?
The Air Force was a new service coming into effect in 1947,
mm-hmm.
and being shot off the Army, we didn't have the traditions, etc., and the years of common thought about how things should be. You know, if you go back in the Army, black units, and in the Navy for that matter, black units were always run by white officers. It was very few times would you see a black officer having any responsibility. In the Air Force, if you're a pilot, you're a pilot.
Right.
If you're a navigator, you're a navigator. If you're a flight engineer, you're a flight engineer. And color was not a regard.
Mm-hmm.
And also because of the way we were crewed. Typical Air Force crew on a 130 was pilot, co-pilot, navigator. They were three officers, and you had your flight engineer and usually two loadmasters. We were a family, mm-hmm. and it didn't matter what color you were. You basically were a family. You lived together. You died together.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And so there was an awful lot of acceptance. You were doing your job. You were accepted.
Right.
And back home, our families typically got together again without regard to the color line.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. You mentioned hair being an issue, and it made me think about the popular culture at the time and the influence that may have had on the Air Force and the military in general. What about as the war progressed and as American culture changed at this time, what about drug use? Did you ever notice any problems with that in the Air Force? Did that ever become an issue?
It never became an issue in the unit I was in.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the Air Force it was a lesser issue. And again, I didn't see the drug use, but I did hear about it. You know, I heard, again, the guys in later Vietnam doing drugs out in the field and
mm-hmm.
this and that. But I did not experience the drug use.
Right. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, I guess now that we've covered those and kind of gotten a little bit off track as far as your career goes, once you, getting back to your career, once you were finished with that assignment at Mather in 69, where did you go from there?
I went to the Royal Canadian Air Force.
Okay.
I went to up to their aerospace systems course,
mm-hmm.
which was one of their military schools, as we have, you know, the military schools in the United States. And I graduated from their ASC course, being one of, I guess, 30 Americans to ever do that. And in fact, I was just listening to something on the radio about being jobless, and I thought, yeah, I can put ASC behind my name because it's a British title.
Yes, sir.
No, I don't know who that would impress, but I can do that.
Right.
it's a class, or I'm sorry, a course where we got an ASC in aerospace engineering.
Okay.
An advanced degree, actually, is what it amounted to.
All right.
So I spent a year doing that coursework, and then I stayed on for 3 years as a squadron commander in the Canadian Air Force, even though I was, you know, attached. I was still in the American Air Force, but I was attached to the Canadian Air Force.
Okay.
And essentially what my job entailed was bringing on the air refueling, next generation air refueling airplane for the Canadian Air Forces and the next generation fighter.
Okay.
It was an interesting assignment.
Yes, sir. What aircrafts would those have been?
I was flying C-47s,
okay.
which were older than I was. an airplane called a CC-109.
Okay.
And the Canadian C-130s.
Okay.
And then I worked with bringing in their refueling, I guess they call it the CF-707 or whatever.
Okay. All right.
And we did a lot of work with industry, obviously trying to channel who could buy what from whom, because they had to buy Canadian policy, we had to buy American policy, and we had to kind of integrate that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had a subculture job that worked for an agency that'll go unnamed.
Okay.
So while I was up there, I was supposed to be doing other things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, in the flying that you did, what types of places would you be? What types of places would you be going to?
Typically, I flew into places like Coal Bay, Coal Lake, you know, all the Canadian bases along the border.
Mm-hmm.
England, came down to the United States and flew to different places because of the integration with industry, Lockheed, Boeing,
mm-hmm.
Grumman.
Okay.
And worked with a lot of nice people.
Yes, sir. Did the people that you work with, did the topic of the war ever come up? Did you discuss the war with them at all?
Oh, yes. Yes, and in fact, when they were first sending a unit over for the peacekeeping force,
mm-hmm.
it happened to be my unit, and obviously I couldn't go because they were going to North Vietnam and they weren't going to welcome an American officer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I had to do a little song and dance and get out of moving with my Canadian outfit and going to work for another Canadian group.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. What did if there was such a thing, did the Canadians that you work with seem to have a general opinion on the war?
Yes, they were very pro Vietnam. They we had a lot of Canadians actually that came down and went over to Vietnam. They had to give up their commissions and become enlisted because they couldn't be commissioned in the American forces.
Mm-hmm.
And I never ran into any Canadians who were anti the war.
Okay.
And I'm talking about the military now. Obviously, in the civilian world, we ran into them. Plus, I often visited with young people who had left the United States and went to Canada to avoid the draft.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Could you talk a little bit about that?
They were exercising their right to leave.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I didn't have a problem. I know I should have, but I didn't. I felt that if they didn't believe in the military and if they didn't want to be there, the worst thing we could do was put them there where, you know, they could either impact how other people survive.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time I would question their motives is if they'd gone to Canada and were working in Canada or doing what they could, you know, to stay out of it, fine. But if they were really, you know, I'm going to do this and I'm going to take some sort of social program from the States and just use that, then I would talk to them. When I'd meet them, you know, we'd have discussions. I'd say, you know, why are you here?
Mm-hmm.
If you're here because you protest the war and don't want to be in the draft, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're here because of other reasons, maybe not fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How would they respond to you?
Generally, I got some negativism, you know. We didn't get a heavy negative because they were already in Canada, but yeah, they were, you know, why do you believe in this or why do you believe in that? And they weren't totally receptive to idealism, but
mm-hmm.
You know, for the most part, they just were kind of neutral.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they had enough drinks.
Right. Yes, sir. How would you run into these Americans that were there in Canada?
I'd run into them in social environments.
Mm-hmm.
If we go down, and we went out to dinner or went down to, you know, the pubs, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty obvious.
Sure. All right. And would they generally come up and talk to you, or the other way around?
Generally, they would start the conversation. I didn't seek them out.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Whenever they would initiate conversations with you, was it? I guess what was their demeanor whenever they would talk to you, beginning before you got the chance to, you know, to kind of fill them out?
Usually, they would ask me why I was there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
They'd see and they say, well, what are you doing up here in Canada?
Uh-huh.
And often they would say, are you here for the same reason we're here? You know, and my answer obviously was, no, if I'm wearing a uniform, I'm probably not trying to avoid the draft.
Right, right, yes, sir.
But, no, I didn't seek them out particularly, but they, if they recognized my uniform, they often did come up and talk.
Okay. All right. So you were in Canada until when? Let's see.
I was there from. I went up there the day after we walked on the moon.
Okay.
So that was 69.
Yes, sir.
And I was there until July of 73.
July of 73. All right. Okay. Where did you go from there?
I went to an ROTC unit in Brookings, South Dakota.
Okay. Where, as the commanding officer?
No.
Okay.
No, I went down there with the... When I got my orders, they told me that's what I was going to do. I got down there, and it didn't work out. The gentleman who was running the outfit was heavy into alcohol, and they replaced him sooner than I would be ready to. So I took over at the end of a year, at the end of the second year. I became the North Central admissions counselor for ROTC programs.
Okay.
And so I, even though I had a physical address again in Brookings, South Dakota, it's where my family lived. I was on the road between North Dakota, South Dakota, parts of Wyoming, and Wisconsin, Minnesota.
Okay. All right. What did you find, what was the attitude towards ROTC at that time in that area?
Up where we were at in the Dakotas, it was very positive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There were pockets, obviously, you know, throughout that region, or mostly to the south, I guess, and more in the cities where it was negative. But the people up on the northern tier are very strong supporters of the military. They were, and I don't think they've ever changed.
Mm-hmm.
I worked places like Grand Forks and Fargo and Minot, and these all had military bases, and for the most part, I think the people were very positive toward them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then, would participation in the ROTC be pretty high?
Yes, we had a very high population in ROTC.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
In fact, I closed one of the Air Force ROTCs up in Grand Forks because at the time their population had dropped a little bit. Their Army unit was still very strong.
Mm-hmm.
But their Air Force unit had dropped a little bit, so I closed it and moved it the people down to Fargo, which was kind of funny because a couple of years later, my son, my oldest boy, went to Grand Forks and became an Army pilot.
Okay. All right. Let's see. You were at this assignment from July of 73 until when?
Until I retired in 79.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess that brings us to close to a close here. But that brings up during that time period. Of course, the war came to an end. But did you have any reaction to the fall of Saigon on April 30th, 75?
To say the least, we were disappointed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
The military had started that by that time. The general military trend had a lot of protest within the ranks.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see as much of it because of where I was at, but, you know, the general feeling was, you know, we spent all this time doing all this. Why are we walking away from it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, yeah, there was disenchantment.
Mm-hmm.
I personally thought that we should have gone into the war and with the idea of winning rather than the idea of just reaching a stalemate or whatever, but that was kind of a difficult time. And when I retired, I didn't spend much time discussing the military with, you know, people around me, even though they knew I had been in the Air Force, except for a couple of college professors who were friends of mine. I did not actively promote the military to my children. I asked them to take a year of ROTC to understand the military and then go on and do whatever they want. And as it turned out, my oldest two sons actually went in the Army.
Okay.
One of them became a helicopter pilot. The other became a missile launcher.
All right.
Now, my third son was so totally anti-military that if he even mentioned Army, he would get his hackles up.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter went to the Air Force Academy.
Okay.
And my third son still is very, very, very anti-military. And I respect that. It doesn't bother me a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But he did, in fact, take 2 years of ROTC.
Right. Yes, sir. This is a question, of course, you don't have to answer this if you don't want, but was it as a result of Vietnam that your son decided, I guess, that gained his
negative attitude?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think Vietnam had a very strong influence on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He became a flower child.
Okay.
And I use that term because that's what, you know, they all said his hair grew nice and long and very curly, and he dressed up in ragged clothes just to show his dislike.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when it started, my commanding officer looked at me and he said, "You have no control of that child." And I says, "Well, I have all the control I need of that child. It's his choice to make his destiny, and I'm not going to interfere with that. If he doesn't want to be in the military and he wants to identify with that movement, that's fine with me."
Right.
That didn't make my commander very happy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, after you retired from the Air Force, what did you do then?
I initially went to work for Bell & Howell in electronics.
Okay.
And I worked for them for about a year. And actually, I was doing quite well. The problem existed when they said that they wanted me to move to Chicago. I'd been born and raised there.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted me to move to Chicago. It was one of those corporate things. And I said, "Well, I don't really want to do that. I'm happy to be here in South Dakota,"
mm-hmm.
which they thought was weird. But they said, "Well, this is not a choice. You're going to move to Chicago." And I said, "Excuse me, you're not the military. It is a choice. I quit."
Right.
And at that point, I had been a school teacher before I went in the military back in 1957. And I said, "You know, I have a degree. I can go teach school, and I'm going to do that." So I went to work in a school on the Indian Reservation in Flandreau, South Dakota.
Okay. All right.
Took a big economic hit.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. How long did you do that?
I taught in Flandreau from, let's see, I guess I was there for 1980, about 7 or 8 years, and then I moved to El Paso where I taught for another 14 or so before I retired.
Okay. All right. Well, before we wrap the interview up, as I've mentioned a few times, I just have some basic questions to just kind of get your opinion on some issues with the war. And again, you can say as much or as little as you'd like. I know we've touched on some of this a little bit, but anyway. Looking back on your Vietnam experience and looking back on the war itself, What did you think about American involvement in Vietnam? Do you think that we should have been there or not?
In the beginning, I was very idealistic, very much in favor of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, through my tour, and I didn't have any problem with the war or my involvement in it. I still don't have any regrets of having done it. My disappointment is that we did not process the war in a way that would have led to a victory for South Vietnam to remain independent. We believed when we went over there that that's what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
We believed in stopping the domino effect.
Right.
We believed in the Russian bear and the Chinese threats, et cetera, et cetera. And in the long run, as President Reagan said, in the long run, we won. But the war itself, the way it ended, was a very negative. It disappointed me, and I hoped from that point on that we would never get involved in a conflict that we were not prepared to process to a victory.
Mm-hmm.
And when we started getting ready for the first Desert Storm, President Bush Sr. started sending troops over. I talked to my wife frequently. I said, you know, I sure hope that we're not going to do what we did in Vietnam, and that is to set up a military invasion and then just leave the people hanging.
Mm-hmm.
And Bush, in my opinion, said that what we were going to do is go in there and free Kuwait.
Right.
And stop the threat to the province, and that's my purpose.
Mm-hmm.
He did that. I know a lot of people disagree. He should have went on to Baghdad, but that was not a part of that program.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, I was very pleased with how Bush ran that particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I say Bush because he was the president.
Right.
I think the military did a good job. We had very minimal losses of our personnel in achieving victory. We learned a lot of lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the time we got to President Bush Jr., I think we forgot them all.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the time we got to Bush Jr., we went back into a military invasion with no purpose. I mean, okay, you could say we wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein. That's fine. They did that. But they had no strategy to what they were going to do after they did that. And so, consequently, as you know, the war is gone on and on and on, both expensive in money and people.
Right.
And I don't see that we're going to come out of it with any positive result. Again, in Desert Storm 1, the people of Iraq were very pro our being there.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're dealing with conditions in Iraq and in Afghanistan where they don't want us. So why, and I ask myself, if they don't want us, why are we there?
Right.
So, I'm not anti-military at all. I'm not anti-protection and doing things that need to be done, i.e. protecting our country, but I don't see a threat from those aspects, a real military threat. The only threat that's out there is somebody's going to cut off your oil.
Mm-hmm.
And in Afghanistan, that ain't even going to happen. And, you know, the Russians spent years in Afghanistan and realized they couldn't do anything.
Right.
And now we've taken over.
Yes, sir.
Foolish us.
Yep.
And I'm afraid that, based on what I hear with the current administration, we're going to make it even worse.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to send more people to a place that don't want us and is not engendering any positive attitude toward America or toward, you know, the American way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be our mission, is to engender a working relationship. You know, I hope, even with the rest of the Mideast, I hope that maybe our new president will be able to sit down with the rogue, what we call rogue governments, and bring them to a table where we can talk instead of shoot at each other.
Mm-hmm.
I would really like to see that.
Right.
I don't know if it'll happen, but I pray for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
maybe that was more than you really wanted to hear.
No, no, no. That's absolutely not. I was going to ask you, but you've already answered that question about your thoughts on U.S. policy post Vietnam. So yeah, definitely that was. But let's see, just a few more questions. What about the press coverage of the Vietnam War? What did you think of it?
I think the press probably did not cover the real war.
Mm-hmm.
We hear about, and I can't say that I know much about the thing, but, you know, the 5 o'clock follies in Saigon. Everybody sat around and got a briefing sheet and then filed briefing sheets. Out in the field, they often went after the spectacular, and, you know, every night people on at home saw the spectacular rather than the day-to-day.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that the coverage was fair and accurate as much as it was slanted the way whoever the particular stations were, the particular companies were, wanted them to be.
Mm-hmm.
And very rarely did we actually see correspondence out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were some, and,
right,
and they were good, and I thought they were very fair, but the guy sitting around the bar in Saigon and getting a briefing sheet, I questioned whether they knew what was happening or not.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the entertainment people, I have a lot of respect for some of them. I hauled Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy around. I hauled Joey Hederlin and some little girl named Tris Noel.
Okay.
And Anne Margaret. You know, these people were out there really entertaining the troops.
Right.
And I got a lot of respect for them. Bob Hope I dearly loved. I never got to see his show because I was always hauling his people around. But, you know, I dearly love him. Every year, he and a whole group of young people came over to make people welcome. And I know when my son-in-law was over in Iraq, Dave Letterman, who I really don't like, but Dave Letterman came over and, you know, spent time with the troops and said, hey, guys, you know, we appreciate you.
Right.
And it's very meaningful to me. But I didn't think the press, per se, was a great reporting corps.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. What's your opinion of U.S. policy towards Vietnam today and the developing relationship that we have with the Vietnamese?
Well, I sure hope we keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
PepsiCo is in there. Kentucky Fried Chicken's in there. My wife and I had talked about going back over. In fact, I guess I would like to, and probably never will, but I would kind of like to go back over and see the country in a peaceful setting rather than in the war setting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all for diplomatic relations with them, because if we're talking, we're not shooting.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. one or two more questions. How would you say, has the war had an effect or an impact on your life?
It impacted my life religiously, somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty nonchalant about my religion, you know, after growing up. I became much deeper a believer in my religion. It impacted, obviously, relationships with friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
Most of it positive, but there were some, you know, very minor negativisms, like my son being anti-military.
Mm-hmm.
But I respected that, and we've not had a problem. You know, we still are as close as family gets, even though we disagree.
Yes, sir.
It probably altered my need for a whole lot of money. When I gave up my electronics job, I gave up about $70,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to do something positive, and I felt that I could do that teaching, working with young people. You know, I worked for years with the anti-drug, anti-crime. Kids that came to me were the ones that were sent by the courts, and I tried to teach them respect. I respect them. They respect me. But we didn't talk a whole lot about the war, but they knew I was in the war. But I've spent the remainder of those years and still do things. I still do interviews for the Air Force Academy, trying to find young people to go in the military who have a, you know, a desire to do that and help them get along or help them get in there.
Okay.
But, yeah, it impacted, but I didn't end up, you know, with what they call that PTSD or whatever.
Yes, sir.
So I never had those problems.
Right.
I do have friends that do.
In your work with the students, were you able to pass along to them? I know you said you didn't really talk about Vietnam. They didn't ask you about Vietnam or anything, but were any of the lessons that you learned from Vietnam, were you able to pass any of those on to them?
The kind of lessons I learned was, you know, believe in yourself, respect others. You don't have to agree with them, agree to disagree, but you don't need to turn that disagreement into violence. In other words, accept acceptance. And I also really worked heavily with those young people because of their situation on integrity. You know, it's what you do when no one's watching that really matters.
Right. Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say or anything else we need to cover before we wrap this up?
No, I'm just really glad that you're doing this. I've written a small diary, I guess, of my military experience, and I've put it away.
Yes, sir.
For when I pass someday, you know, for the kids, if they're interested, they can look through and read it. Good friend of mine, you know, well, he's become a good friend, wrote about a lot of our experiences, including myself, in a book a number of years ago. And so it's been interesting. But, yeah, one of the things the Vietnam experience has done, and I suspect this is pretty common, is it welded friendships that have been so strong. We still get together. My B-50 unit gets together at least once a year. The 130 unit, many of us either get together or we call each other, or if we're traveling anywhere, we always stop off and visit with each other. Something I didn't have from growing up in Chicago. My friendships have remained very strong for 40, 50 years.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, thank you very much for your participation, Mr. Well,
thank you for inviting me to participate.
I've enjoyed talking with you the past few days. If you don't mind, I'll stop the recording and talk again for just a few more minutes.
An orange study.
Okay.
And it was called Project Ranch Hand. You may have heard of it.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm a part of that. I had cancer.
Oh, okay.
And whether, you know, the cancer is accepted or not accepted as being a part of Agent Orange, I don't know. I have friends who Agent Orange has impacted heavily. But, again, I know that's another subject, but Agent Orange was a strong influence, I guess, on our post-Vietnam experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Could you... would you mind talking a little bit about the study itself? And
no. I don't remember what the year was exactly, about 24 years ago, 25 years ago. I was contacted by the Air Force. It was just about the time I was leaving the Air Force and I was in the civilian world. And they wanted to know whether I would be interested in taking part in the study because being a navigator, I had logbooks, and they asked if I had logbooks. I knew where I was any time I flew. You know, I could reference where I was.
Right.
And so I basically joined the study group. The first time we did something, we went down to Texas to, I think it was Sloan Kettering, and they got a baseline of our military history, sort of like what you're doing, only for a different purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And that was to find out where we were exposed, when we were exposed, how often.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did baseline medical work on us to determine how much residual Agent Orange we had in our systems, because it, I guess, stays in the fatty tissue.
Okay.
And about every 2 to 4 years after that, we would come back for another medical evaluation, psychological evaluations, etc. And for 20 years, that study went on.
Mm-hmm.
And the results of the study, I guess, have been pretty much published.
Yes, sir.
But a lot of what they anticipated, in as far as cancers went, may not have occurred. There are a number of cancers that they say are directly related to Agent Orange.
Mm-hmm.
But heart problems and diabetes reared their ugly heads as sort of an unknown,
mm-hmm.
and have become very functionally involved with the Agent Orange experience. I had cancer. My cancer, unfortunately, was 2 inches higher than it should have been, so I'm not receiving any compensation for it.
Mm.
They recognize prostate cancer. They don't recognize bladder cancer.
Huh.
I don't know how you separate them, because when they took out my bladder, they took out my prostate.
Right.
But, again, I'm not into the scientific field. I've got all the reports. They're, during the study, they were very good as far as the type of, what do you call it, diagnostic medical stuff they did and psychological medical stuff they did. They got the wives and briefed them and kept them sort of up to date. The only one I was worried about, and she had some effect maybe from the dioxins, was my daughter. She had some medical problems when she was first born.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, has overcome them. But the study, I think, was well done, well documented. The Agent Orange thing that they do for the general troops, the non-ranch hand study, I don't know, because the VA is doing it, and I'm not totally confident the VA ever knows what they're doing.
Right.
I do not go to VA hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, that brings up another question that I want to ask you then is, how do you feel about the government? How do you feel about how the government's taking care of its veterans, or has it?
I think the government treats their veterans shabbily.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly this generation of veterans.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came in the Air Force, I thought at the end of my Air Force experience, the promises made were, you know, medical care for family and for yourself for the rest of your life. And kind of was impressed. We thought that the medical system of the military was good, and I think in the beginning it was.
Mm-hmm.
But as the World War II veterans started to move on, the Korean War veterans started to move on, Vietnam having been not particularly popular, we started to see less and less VA involvement. And to go to a VA hospital, I had to go once or twice for a retirement physical and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
To see how they were treating the, you know, the people, I was disappointed. I've been to the VA hospital once or twice down in San Antonio, not for my own sake, but taking a friend of mine out there.
Mm-hmm.
And the hours he spends and the way they tend to treat him, very shabby.
Mm-hmm.
When I put in my, I put in a claim for the cancer, and the kind of response I got from him was very negative.
Mm-hmm.
So I Haven't had much to do with them since. But what I hear about, again, the kids coming back out of Iraq, et cetera, and the sort of treatment and the shredding of documents, everything I keep hearing, I'm embarrassed for the people involved. I truly am.
Yes, sir.